Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. So welcome to the early edition. This is our Friday morning. We start a little bit earlier on Fridays. In fact, I used to start the show at 6 o'clock every day. And then I found out that most of our callers and guests were from the middle and the western part of the country. And the East Coast, I guess you haven't quite caught on yet. You know, we know you're out there somewhere, but a lot of our folks call from there. So that's why we do the show a little bit later most days. And, of course, Thursdays, we do the show from 10 in the morning until 1 p.m. in the afternoon. And that's because one of our favorites, our team captain of the world's greatest docs, Dr. Judy Mikovits, is on the West Coast. And so rather than have her get up at 5 in the morning and have to struggle through or 4 in the morning and have to, have a couple cups of coffee and go, especially all the traveling she does and all the amazing things that she does, I changed the showtime and all the doctors agreed. And it's really interesting. Our Thursday show is incredible because these are doctors who are, still talking to patients. They're taking conference calls. They're going in and out. Like Judy was in the first hour and the third hour. And then Jim was supposed to drop the first hour, but he canceled the meeting to be on the show. And that's Jim Thorpe. And so these amazing people. And Brian had to take off for an interview. He had to go drive to do a show or something like that because he has a show. He has a TV show. But they all like the show. And we've had some incredible guests drop in. Tiffany Perotto, who's a marketing genius. And we had Brandon House, who is his own media, TV, radio personality and produced Mike Lindell's election videos. And yesterday we had Gregory Wrightstone, who's a climate geologist. And you might be asking yourself, well, why would you have a climate geologist on a doctor's panel? Well, simple, because both climate change and COVID have the same government oppression. They use propaganda to create fear so they can gain control. I mean, the parallels are incredible. And it was really fascinating to listen to the doctors talk to Gregory and Gregory to our doctors and this is one of my fascinations with the show, is to match people up who generally would not be matched up with each other. You know, doctors go to doctors' conferences and geologists go to geologist conferences, but you don't see a lot of doctors at geologist conferences, until now. And so I'm hoping to match these people up and match other people up. All right, today's a busy day. We've got Shirley Watchell at the bottom of the hour. With DCE Project Women and Guns Report. We've got Jen Dykes at the top of the next hour with the Second Amendment Report. We've got Derek Park at the bottom of the next hour with our financial report. And we have our new bill writer, Amber Kemper, who's going to start her Constitution Report. And that'll be the top of the third hour. And the last half of the third hour, I haven't figured out yet. But this is a day to kind of hang out. So the first half hour is mine. And so what I want to talk about today is something that is not in the news but should be. And so this is something out of California. This is a good thing out of California, all right? It's called the CAPS, the Californians for Population Stabilization. And now you would think that would be a good liberal term, right? This sounds very left. It's not. It's just the opposite. And they have a legislative action center. And what they've done is they have a petition, which I put on my website too. It says, action alert, tell Congress to eliminate what they're calling accidental birthright citizenship. So birthright citizenship is this big lie. You want to talk about a big lie? This is a big lie. That anybody born on U.S. soil is automatically a U.S. citizen. Now, we've talked about this, I don't know how many times. It's very simple. They're not. There is no law passed by Congress. There is nothing in the Constitution. And so, therefore, there's nothing for the Supreme Court to say that it exists. All right. There is no authority granted to the federal government to make people citizens just because they're born here. In fact, the 14th Amendment says just the opposite. It says that the only way you can be a U.S. citizen is to be a natural born citizen or naturalized. And the way you're a natural born means you're born here to parents who are U.S., at least one who's a U.S. citizen, or at least one who's a lawful permanent resident. And to be naturalized means you gain U.S. citizenship through applying. You don't have to be born here for that. Obviously not. I was born in Canada and I'm an American citizen. But what happens is you have to apply and come in the legal way. So that's how you get your citizenship. So what the 14th Amendment says very clearly, and we've been over this countless times, but just for the sake of our new listeners and our new folks, our Canadian, Australian, and English audience is growing really fast. I mean, I'm impressed with what's going on. For a 14th Amendment, probably the most important clause of the Constitution, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. And we've talked about that too. But let's just concentrate on the fact that this is a citizenship jurisdiction. This is not a geographical jurisdiction. So what people are doing, the reason that they misinterpret this, A, they want more citizens, hopefully to vote Democrat, because the Democrats are pushing this, and B, they don't understand the difference between citizenship jurisdiction and geographic jurisdiction, okay? So in other words, you can be born in the United States of foreign parents. Geographically, you're under the jurisdiction of the United States if you commit crimes or things like that, or if you're here illegally. You're under the jurisdiction of the United States because you're on U.S. soil, but you're not of the United States. You know, the Constitution says we the people of the United States, not we the people in the United States. So the only way you can be a person of the United States, in other words, a U.S. citizen, is to be born or naturalized, okay? Now, and this is the big thing, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Because so what kind of jurisdiction, like they say, are they talking about? Citizenship jurisdiction. Okay, so in other words, this is not a geographic clause. This is a citizenship clause. And you know that because they're talking about citizenship, born or naturalized U.S. citizens, you know, and citizens of the state in which they reside, okay? So it's very clear that this is a citizenship jurisdiction. Now, what does it mean to be subject to our jurisdiction by citizenship? Well, that means that you're a citizen of the United States. If you're a citizen of another country, you're subject to their jurisdiction. This is not tough to understand, but it's easy to lie about, apparently. And so the big lie is that people born on U.S. soil are U.S. citizens, and the simple fact is they're not. Okay, they never have been. So we've got millions upon millions upon millions of people who've been given accidental citizenship. Okay. Wrongly. I mean, it's horrible. And then, of course, by chain migration, they brought in, millions more people. Okay. So all that has to stop. Not only does it have to stop, it has to be revoked. If you were given something wrongly, it has to be taken back because it was never yours to begin with. Okay. It's like if a bank pays you, you know, $10,000 extra by mistake, you know, can you keep it? No. If they discover the mistake, you know, 5 years later, can they take their money back? Sure, because you should have given it back in the first place because it was a mistake. Okay, so something wrongly given to you can be taken back. So wrongly given citizenship not only has to be taken back, we have to take it back as far as we can go. Now, that's going to put millions of people in limbo in this country. Well, that's for Congress to figure out. That's not our problem. Our problem is to stop this ridiculous invasion of our country by a mistake. So let me read you the bill. So this is CAPS, and you can find them online. Californians for Population Stabilization. It's on my Facebook page. But just look them up. CAPS. Californians for start again, Greg. Californians for Population Stabilization. There we go. And the Legislative Action Center. And the action alert is on this here. It says very, very clearly, Congress. It says action alert, tell Congress to eliminate accidental birthright citizenship. I love that term, accidental. I'm going to adopt that. Anyway, let's get to Pianki on the line here. Pianki, it's going to be a busy Friday, but I got some good news. These folks are actually trying to do something. Good morning, sir.
Well, it's good. I got all the kids here in the neighborhood up bright and early and bushy eyes waiting to hear Amber report.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, Amber's going to be on at 8 o'clock, so we got a couple more hours before we get to Amber. But Amber's fabulous.
Yes,
and
they eat the cereal and Wheaties, so they can it'd be ready.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Well, it's also a podcast, too, if they get distracted for any reason. But, you know, if they want to call in and talk to Amber, that's fine, too. So she doesn't have the full hour. I think she only has half an hour. And I may put another report. I'm losing time. I'm running out of time for reports. Things are getting kind of busy around here. And so it's crazy what's going on. I may have to go to 4 hours. Oh, my God. Can I do that? We'll think about that. Anyway, so this is one of our regular topics here. You and I have talked about this many times, that there is no right to become a citizen simply because you're born on U.S. soil. You have to be eligible. And the way that you're eligible is that you have parents who are citizens, or you have parents that are legal immigrants, lawfully in the country and have been granted immigrant status and have the green card. So there is a bill, though. It's not as good as mine, which is understandable, but there is a bill. Yeah, go ahead, sir. You're going to say something.
No, I didn't say anything.
Oh, okay. I must have heard that comment.
Thinking pretty hard.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, maybe I heard that. You never know. Anyway, so there's a bill, H.R. 140. And it says, tell Congress to pass H.R. 140 and jettison birthright citizenship. So it's a quick alert. So I'll get to this fairly fast here. It says, despite the misimpression presented by the media, the Supreme Court has never ruled that the 14th Amendment of the Constitution passed to ensure that former slaves were considered U.S. citizens grants citizenship to the American-born children of illegal aliens, foreign students, tourists, or temporary foreign workers in the United States. And they got an article, more details by Rick Oberlink in USA Today, which is kind of interesting. It was back in 2015, so maybe they were actually reporting real news then. It says, according to the Center for Immigration Studies, about 372,000 babies are born in the U.S. to illegal aliens. Well, they say immigrants, but I'll say illegal aliens, tourists, and other non-citizens each year, about 8% of all U.S. births. Granting citizenship to anyone and everyone born on U.S. soil has led to a flourishing birth tourism industry and serves as an inducement for more illegal immigration. The parents of anchor babies are almost never deported. So we've got to change that, okay? And so if you're given something wrongly, the natural cure for that is to, of course, take it back. So all these wrong citizenships, these accidental birthright citizenships have to be revoked. Now, the bill...
You're absolutely right.
Go ahead. Oh, thank you.
And the precedent for that is just like the Supreme Court has reversed this Roe decision, which was erroneous, put in place, should I say considered back in the time that it was considered.
So, well, the Supreme Court doesn't have to reverse it. There's nothing to reverse. There's no law. This is just a policy, and it isn't even a lawful policy. There's nothing to reverse. In fact, go ahead.
When they do it, it shouldn't be that much pushback because, hey, it was a mistake. You take people out of prison because you made a mistake in the decision and so forth.
That's a
they
really good point.
They try to do this thing with the this lady result with Emmett Till case. I don't think they're going in place, but they like to go back and make correct mistakes. So the mistake of people coming here illegally, having babies, and they've been becoming citizenship, that's a mistake. It needs to be corrected. They need to be said adios.
Yep. No, that's a really good way to put it because I was trying to think how to do it because people are going to say, you're taking away U.S. citizenship. I said, no, you're not. This is a mistake. This is an accident. This never should have happened. You know, it's like I said, my example was if the bank gives you $10,000, you know, can you keep it? No. That was a mistake.
If the IRS give you refund you $100,000 and you didn't even make that much in wages, it's a mistake. Should they take it back?
Yeah. Well, they will. Well, in the same way that that's a really good point too, because if the IRS can take back money that was illegally given to you, then the Congress can correct the mistake of citizenship that was illegally granted. So these are illegal grants of citizenship because it violates the 14th Amendment, you know. And so in that respect, it should be easy to revoke them. I don't even know if we need – maybe this can be done by presidential executive order because there is no law. You know, this is a mistake, and hospitals are doing this all the time. So you really – you know, you have to stop the hospitals from writing birth certificates that have American citizens on them when they're not because they're the ones who are doing
it.
States
should do it also.
Who's that?
The states. The states should do it also.
Yeah, the states can definitely correct it. Yeah.
How are you going to bestow a citizenship on me that you're not entitled to have at the federal level?
You know, that's a good point, too. I should add a provision that the states do not have to – the states shall not recognize – so states shall not recognize accidental birthright citizenship. So in other words, the state of Florida should pass a bill that any – and they can check citizenship. You know, well, how did you get your citizenship? Well, I was born here. Well, were your parents legal? No. Well, then you're not a resident. You're not a citizen of Florida, you know, or Missouri or any place that, you know, state shall not.
You can call us the Checkpoint Charlie bill.
I actually went through there.
You did?
Uh-huh.
You got through?
Yeah, both ways. I actually came back too. That's a funny story. I'm writing madly away here. Not accidental birthright citizenship. Yeah. When I was a kid and I was, you know, pretty daring and carefree and all those other, birthright. I shouldn't try to do too many things to birth. Right. I don't mind writing something wrong, but if I say something wrong, I'm going to be in trouble. Birthright citizenship. So let me just do this real quickly. Citizenship. There we go. Yeah, no, I crossed Checkpoint Charlie, but the fun thing was I met a couple of really cool you know, fellow young folks there, and we hang out all day, and we were discussing the virtues of communism and freedom. It was a really interesting discussion. They tried to convince me that their communism was better. I was laughing. Yeah, I don't think so. If you saw West Berlin, you know, because I was in East Berlin, and they said if you saw West Berlin, you'd see the error in your ways. But given this rep point, you know, this is all you know. Then yeah, I understand why you think the way you do. But it was the most boring, dull place. Oh God, it was horrible. The problem was I spent too much time with them, and I almost missed curfew. I went through Checkpoint Charlie, you know, coming back, but about 10 minutes before they closed down the border. You know, 10 minutes later, I would have been a deep, you know what? I would have caused an international incident. Of course, everybody only goes in for – most people go in for a couple of hours. They walk around their little show place, their little fairgrounds on the other side of the wall, and go home and think, oh, communism's not so bad. No, I went about 10 or 15 miles into East Berlin. I mean, I walked a lot. You know, I met some folks, and they had to race in their little East German vehicle, whatever it was, to get me back to the border. And this huge guard, this huge, bald, bad-breath East German guard with the AK-47 just looks at me like, what the hell are you doing here this late? You know, and he goes, das Boot bitte. Okay, yeah, here it is, pal. Sorry. You know, I got carried away. So I crossed Checkpoint Charlie once in the morning and once about 10 minutes before the border closed. So that's my story.
Sounds like it was an experience.
It was an experience. Oh, yeah. Listen, I was never so glad to get back to freedom. I got drunk that night. So the only time I think I got drunk my whole trip because I wanted to stay in control. But I was so glad to be back in freedom. I was only in communism for one day. And one day was enough, you know, and it was so miserable and so depressing. It was like, you know, Dante's, you know, hell. You know, and it was just, there was no life. There's no excitement. There's no advertising. There's no color. Everybody was dead. I mean, they're walking around dead, even though they were living. It was like living dead. That's how I describe communism. Anyway, Birthright Citizenship Act by Representative Babin, B-A-B-I-N, Republican of Texas, H.R. 140, would bring America into the 21st century. Industrialized nations in Europe and across the globe have ended birthright citizenship. See, I don't even like the term birthright citizenship. I would call it accidental citizenship or wrongly granted citizenship. I'll figure a name for it. You'll probably help me with that too. And the last sentence, even the immigrant nations of New Zealand and Australia have abolished it in recent decades. So it says, let your senators and representatives know it is time to pass H.R. 140, the Birthright Citizenship Act. Well, of course, I have a retort to that. I wrote another one 4 years ago. But let's get the text of their bill and tell me what you think. So I have this here, text of H.R. 140, 117th Congress, which is now 2021 to 2022. So this bill is currently in the House Judiciary Committee, which under Nancy Pelosi will go nowhere. This is a dead bill because it was sponsored by a Republican. Republican bills will not pass as long as Nancy Pelosi is Speaker of the House. But at least they're trying. So this is H.R. 140, to amend Section 301 of the Immigration and Nationality Act to clarify those classes of individuals born in the United States who are nationals and citizens of the United States at birth. So they actually do it backwards. And the bill says, short title, this act may be cited as the Birthright Citizenship Act of 2021. It should be the Mistaken Citizenship Repeal Act of 2021. That's what it should be. And it just basically says, it says the following, here's the new definition. It says, acknowledging the right of birthright citizenship established by Section 1 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. See, that's wrong, okay? A person born in the United States shall be considered subject to the jurisdiction of the United States for purposes of subsection A1, if the person is born in the United States of parents, one of whom is a citizen of the United States or national of the United States, I'm not quite sure the difference, an alien lawfully admitted for permanent residence in the United States whose residence is in the United States, or an alien performing active service in the armed forces as defined in Section 101 of Title 10, the United States Code. I'm not sure if that should apply either. I'm going to think about that military thing because if you're a foreign person, if you're a foreign person in serving in our military, should that grant citizenship?
No,
I don't think so. Now, if you're serving for the purposes of gaining citizenship, yes, but just because you're serving in the military, no. So this bill has flaws. So that's their bill. What do you think?
No, you're right. It shouldn't be. And I'll tell you something else, too. You talk about the 14th Amendment and slaves. You can't grandfather. You can't go back in the time and say, well, you were born in 1732, so you should be given. No, you can't do that. It's from this point on.
Why can't we make it retroactive? If we're correcting a mistake, why can't I go back as far back as we can go in the records?
You can go back to take away, but you can't go back to give. You got it illegally, but you can't go back and give it to them legally in the past. No, how are you going to do that? Come on.
Well, no, I'm like not talking about that. What I'm saying
IRS,
is anybody...
In 2020, IRS gave you $300,000 too much. Well, they can go back and take it, but they
right.
can't say today that we're going to give you $300,000 too much for 2020. So I think that it should be granted from this point on not to go back. And it only makes sense. I mean, come on, how far back are you going
to
go?
Well, I'm not trying to give citizenship. I'm trying to correct the mistake of mistaken citizenship.
I'm not saying you are. I'm saying that it couldn't.
Oh, okay.
Was,
so let's go back to that bill. I'm not quite sure what you're talking about here. So let me pull that
bill
again.
Well, I was saying like the 14th Amendment, which
right.
came on the heel of the Dred Scott case.
Right.
When Justice Taney said that a Negro has no right that a white man is bound to respect. Well, technically that was true because they weren't citizens. And the motion into it. So Congress passed the bill, which now the 14th Amendment that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
and people saying that, well, the people that were born 40 years before this bill should be citizens. Well, really
oh,
not because.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But in terms of today, there's no reason why we can't go back as far as we can go back. You know, Kamala Harris is an illegal alien. Her parents were not lawfully in the country. They both had expired student visas. I think one had an expired visa and the other one didn't even have a visa. So they were not lawfully
yeah,
in the country.
It's,
so therefore, she could not
like
have been
fraud.
Made a U.S. citizen. Like who?
It's like fraud. Look at those Virgin Hotels out in San Francisco. You heard about them. The Chinese
oh, yeah.
kept going, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All those folks need to have had the mistake corrected. So what we need is we should call it the Citizenship Correction Act. I like that. Citizenship
Fraud Correction Act.
Or Fraudulent Citizenship Correction. Well, it's not really fraud because these people, you know, they came here expecting this policy to be honored, but the policy itself is the problem. You know, do I fault people for coming here to take advantage of a mistaken policy? No. But they can't get the benefit of U.S. citizenship simply because they followed a fraudulent policy. So, you know, and they, you know, and yes, they made plans and yes, the things, you know, well, stuff happens. Okay. We need to fix this because these millions of people, 300,000 people a year, you know, there's an organization called Numbers USA, that figured out that the sustainable number, in other words, the equal number of immigrants to keep the immigrant, you know, numbers stable year to year is 250,000. So we have more people coming here to give birth to Americans than we should have legal immigrants. You know, so only 250,000
mm-hmm.
people a year should be coming to the United States. You know, that's what they figure.
Hey,
so we've got
that many people. You got that much for so many people. Then just look at these prisoners that we got in prison. What,
mm-hmm.
2 million? Well, let's
yeah.
rehabilitate them and put them to doing something productively. That way mm-hmm. that they can contribute to the tax system.
Yeah. Well, I don't, like I say, illegal
See,
aliens can't contribute.
Well, no, you're right. But that's what the I-10 number
yeah.
is for. But what I'm
yeah,
saying
yeah, no,
is you're going to.
Yeah. Go ahead, because I want to get this bill, and we got 6 minutes before Shirley gets here, so I want to make sure I get our
ahead.
Bill into our conversation. Okay. So here's the current law. And this is where it gets screwed up. So the thing that they're talking about, the Immigration and Nationality Act, Section 301, says nationals and citizens of the United States at birth. It's Section 301, 8 U.S.C. 1401. The following shall be nationals and citizens of the United States at birth. A person born in the United States, and then it says, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. But what they do is they leave off the subject to the jurisdiction clause, and they say a person born in the United States, and they forget the other half. Okay. So what I did, my proposed law, is section, you know, 1401 USC Title 8 is amended by adding language to clarify the subject to the jurisdiction clause. Clause A will now read, instead of saying a person born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, it will say a person born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Subject to the jurisdiction thereof means persons not subject to the jurisdiction of any other nation through citizenship in any other nation, nor owing allegiance to any other nation, nor illegal alien in this nation, nor subject to or of any nation or foreign power or entity. It means every human being born within the jurisdiction of the United States of parents not owing allegiance to any foreign sovereignty. All nations have jurisdiction over their citizens and therefore responsibility for their citizens, to whom those citizens are subject to this jurisdiction thereof. I should probably slow down. No child born of parents from a foreign jurisdiction can have jurisdiction within the United States, even if born on the soil or within the boundaries of the United States or its territories. All such persons born of parents with foreign jurisdiction on the soil of the United States shall be the responsibility of such foreign nations and shall have no claim of U.S. birthright whatsoever, and under no circumstances to citizenship of or from the United States, regardless of where or by what circumstances they are born. That's Section A. Section B, given the national emergency of decades of people stealing American citizenship on merely a policy that was never a duly passed law and is the opposite of the Constitution's declaration on citizenship jurisdiction, resulting in flooding this nation with false American citizens, all such so-called birthright citizenships given to babies born on U.S. soil for any reason or circumstance to parents not subject to your U.S. citizenship jurisdiction, as outlined in Clause A above, shall have such misawarded U.S. citizenships revoked, as such citizenships never legally existed in the first place. It shall be U.S. policy to go back as far as records allow to rectify this national emergency and break every migration chain award based on a misawarded birthright citizenship. This will result in a change and therefore correction to the legal and citizenship status of millions of people, the original false citizenship policy implementation of which created this national emergency in the first place. Therefore, almost done. The sooner the revocation of misawarded citizenships and chain migration statuses begins, the sooner the national emergency will be over and the recovery with a nation of people with their proper status can begin. Congress will then have to deal with millions of people who cannot and should never have citizenship nor legal migration status, such that Congress will probably have to establish a new status for people given something they were never allowed to have. How's that?
That's a great start.
Yeah, well, that's the whole bill. That's it. That's all there is. Then I have a little thing in the beginning. It says, what law requires birthright citizenship? This is my background. Is automatic birthright citizenship for children of all legal and illegal aliens expressly required by the U.S. Constitution? On its face, the answer is no. No language in the Constitution specifically addresses how the children of foreigners must be dealt with in regards to citizenship. The 14th Amendment confers citizenship through naturalization or by birth to persons, quote, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, but provides no guidance on when an alien is to be regarded as subject to the U.S. jurisdiction. The next question then is whether any statute enacted by Congress specifically directs the granting of citizenship to children born in the United States to illegal aliens. Again, the answer is no. The executive branch's birthright citizenship policy is not based on any federal regulation. One might say that the practice has become policy without becoming law. That actually comes from the I took that and I quote it here somewhere. That's from what's it called? The CIS, the Center for Immigration Studies. That's Mark Krikorian. That oh here we go. That's here we quote. It says the Center for Immigration Studies has this paragraph on their site page on birthright citizenship. That's the first paragraph I read. Then again to my stuff. And I said, since there's no law and it's not in the Constitution, here a bill to amend the Immigration and Nationality Act so birthright citizenship does have a law and that law makes it illegal. My choice would be to make it retroactive back 10 years because there is no law allowing birthright citizenship. So I would say go back as far as you can. I think the further we go back, the better that this is to correct this mistake. And we got computers. It wouldn't be too hard to trace people. You know, if the federal government won't do it, then the states have to do it. And this is going to be a big issue, Pianca. I'm curious what you think. We've got a couple of minutes before Shirley gets here. But the idea that the states stand up to the federal government and say, look, you may have granted citizenship illegally, but we're not going to do that. We're going to check everybody.
Absolutely.
And,
absolutely.
You know, yep. You know, so if you were born, were your parents
holy, holy, hallelujah. Holy, holy, hallelujah.
Yeah. So a citizenship check for voting, for example, or for state residents should require a check of whether your parents we're legally citizens of the United States, you know, when you're born. Or, and if you're born in a foreign country, of course, it's easy. You know, and it's you know, it's really clearly defined in law, actually. You know, American citizens are those who are born to American citizens or lawful public or lawful permanent residents, you know, green card holders, immigrants. That's it. It actually doesn't matter where they are. If you're born in Paris and your parents are American citizens, or one of them is, you're an American citizen. You know, so citizenship is not geographical. And this is the thing that people don't get, that citizenship is its own jurisdiction, and it's not based on geography. Anyway,
there should be penalties to coaches, people that's coaching these undocumented, these illegals, on how to circumvent U.S. law. Lawyers should be punished, should be fined.
Well, there's no law against what they're doing. See, this is the reason I wrote this law, is to make it against the law.
There should be one against, and there should be one against what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the Internal Revenue Code, there have been cases where people, Aaron Russo and others, for giving individuals information on how to circumvent the U.S. Tax system, have been punished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are statutes in IRS codes that are clear about what you can and can't do. Well, actually, they're not that clear. That's why there's problems. But as far as citizenship goes, there is a mistaken belief, and there is no specific policy against it. So this is why, and I got Shirley online, so I want to get to her real quick here. But this is why when Trump was in office, and I kept talking to my congressman, Matt Gaetz, and I kept saying, you got to stop this. You know, there is no policy that allows for birthright citizenship, so just make it illegal. You know, in other words, it would be a presidential correction of a policy that doesn't exist. All you have to say is this policy does not exist. Stop doing it. You know, I don't know if that requires a law from Congress, Snipes, because it's already against the law, according to the Constitution.
Wesley Snipes spent time in jail over some tax scheme, I think it was 806, I believe it was, trying to look at saying they were still slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And there's no statute of limitations on this, because if you're mistakenly, if you're getting incorrect citizenship we'll think of a good term for it. If you're granted something that you were never allowed to have, I don't care how far back it goes, there's no statute of limitations on that. Anyway, let's get to Shirley and let's talk DC Project Women and Guns. When one is faced with a crisis, you find your true character. How you react to such an emergency can determine the rest of your life. Two paths present themselves for you to choose. One leads to tragedy. The other leads to becoming a new person. Shirley Wattrall, a survivor of a dangerously abusive relationship, is that new person. She is the author of Heels to Holster. She is a firearms instructor, motivational speaker, women's empowerment advocate, and a reporter for Action Radio. So now, here is the DC Project Women and Guns with Shirley Wattrall. I like that scene. I'm excited. Tell me stuff. Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning.
So what's going on?
I got some exciting stuff happening. The DC Project, we're starting to get ready for our trip to DC.
All right.
Yeah, that's going to be in September. We just had a meeting and touched base on some of the things we'll be doing there. So that's really exciting, because I've never been there with them when they meet with the legislators and we talk to them about the Second Amendment and why it's important to us.
Ooh,
so we're
going to
be there.
My first question. Actually, my second question. Well, I got two questions immediately. One, can you call us from D.C. if you're there on a Friday?
Well, we're going to be in a rally. I don't really know. From what I understand, the schedule is really crazy. They say be ready to walk 5 to 8 miles a day.
Okay.
So I got to start getting my walking shoes going.
Get your walking shoes. Yeah, get some good sneaks. You know, get your walking. Get your Rockports or whatever snooty shoes you're going to wear.
Yeah, because you don't want to wear heels. You know, take dress your shoes when you go in.
So you're going to be from sneakers to holster? This is your next book or what?
From sneakers to heels. Yeah. That'll be a good, that should be a good
from
one.
From sneakers to Congress.
But we are. Yeah, there you go. Let's see. Oh, it could be boots. What's that song? Something about boots. These boots are going to walk
all
over you.
Boots were made for
yeah,
walking. Nancy Sinatra.
Yeah, boots were made for
one
walking.
One of these days, these boots are going to walk all over you. And the bass goes, boom, 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 boom. Anyway, yeah. Of course, my next question is, can you take some of our legislation with you? Is it legal for you guys to lobby and take some of our gun bills with you to Congress?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm, like I said, I'm a newbie at this. I'm kind of just going to be going along and seeing how everything works.
Okay.
We separate into different groups and we make different appointments. And I'm excited because I don't know how this all comes together, but I've heard some awesome things about it and how I know your time frame is limited and you're supposed to, this is, you know, you get in there and you get out, you don't run late. Mm-hmm. Their time is precious, and so is mm-hmm. ours. So we have to get in, get out, say what we need to. But we are doing a rally.
Okay.
We are doing – so anyone that's in D.C. on September 16th from 1 to 4 mm-hmm. can stop by and rally with us.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be at the Capitol Lawn. I was at the rally a couple of years ago. I did go to a rally. That was before I even got involved in D.C. Project, which was kind of cool, actually. It was actually pretty cool.
Yeah, so,
you're not rallying inside
the Capitol building, right? Just to make sure. I mean, there have been some issues with that, in the past.
No, we will be outside the Capitol building.
Okay. Yeah. The rally is outside. The walkthrough is inside.
There you go.
I'm teasing you. Yeah. Well, since you're back till September, maybe you can get Diana Mueller, who is the head of this in D.C.
Uh-huh.
If we can get her on the show before then we can find out if you can bring some of the bills to Congress, like the hearing protection bill, which would take suppressors off the National Firearms Act, our tax credits, tax deduction bill to make firearms more accessible to people, especially of low income. We've got some good bills. Our change in registration, where you put the prohibited list, with the gun dealers, and if you're not on the prohibited list, you can buy a gun right there. We've got some really decent bills that would improve the situation. That I think you could take to Congress. And you got some good people in Florida delegation to talk to. Matt Gaetz, my congressman here. We've got to some other folks that it would be very pro-Second Amendment as well.
I'll talk to her and see what we can put together.
Okay, we got time.
Yeah, I guess from what I understand, the groups that we are in, whoever heads the group makes the appointments. And mm-hmm. I don't know how we get divided into our groups. It's all brand new to us, but they've done it for, couldn't do it for 2 years because
mm-hmm.
of COVID. They did it in a minor, smaller
so stupid.
Setting because they shut
just
down
government
D.C.
unrepresentative.
Yeah.
Well,
I think so. We've been active for 6 years. So I guess for 4 years they've been doing it. So.
Okay. Well, let me give you my crash course in lobbying. Lobbying is education. Okay, that's mostly what you're educating folks on the issues because they're not experts. They have so many people talking about so many issues. Just make it really clear, straightforward, that think of this as an education rather than you have to believe what I say kind of thing. And a wise old corporate lobbyist wrote something years and years ago that I picked up when I was in Washington during my internship in the 80s. He says, don't beg, don't threaten, and don't assume you're right 100% of the time. So that's your lobbyist creed from the corporate lobbyists themselves. Don't beg. Don't threaten and don't assume you're right 100% of the time. And they'll listen to what you have to say. How's that sound?
No, that sounds great. Yeah.
Okay.
That's kind of what we're going over all this time. We've been learning about that from what I mm-hmm. understand anyway. So yeah, we're not going in there, smashing our fists or anything. We're the calm
mm-hmm.
group. We're not the anti group, which is hollering and screaming. We're the calm group that just,
they like that.
Like
that makes a huge difference. The messenger and the method of messaging is what gets a message listened to. And so you always want to be, we're on your side. We want to help you, protect our rights even better. And this is how you can do it. So you always want to have something
right.
in it for
just,
them. So this is right. how we can help you. Yeah, go ahead.
And we're there to back them up on the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Massey, I just posted, I just saw this record, I don't know who he was speaking in front of. But he was speaking highly about the Second Amendment and about the bill that was being proposed. So I just posted that. Oh, I didn't get it to action.
I know. See, now I've been posting your stuff. You know, you finally, you beat me this week, finally. You beat me to the gun saving lives, to the gun group. Usually I beat you.
Once in a while, I do surprise myself. And
don't forget your little Action Radio folks here. You know, this is why we're here, to give you yet another outlet for DC Project, you know, stuff. But, yeah.
We appreciate it. Totally appreciate it. Yeah, well, now that you brought in that segue, let's go ahead and talk about
Shall we? Yes, please do.
And how we can be our own protector. Mm-hmm. This week's story happened in Wyoming. It was posted by, I love this, Cowboy State Daily. I love that newspaper name. I don't know why. So here we have this woman. She has this ex-boyfriend who apparently doesn't like being an ex, and she was in a relationship with another gentleman. Mm-hmm. And her ex-boyfriend starts to attack her current boyfriend. And the sheriff's office said that she retrieved a pistol and felt she had no choice but to use deadly force to stop the violent attack to protect herself and her current boyfriend. So she retrieved her firearm. She shot at her ex-boyfriend and shot him in the arm, and it went through and lodged in his rib cage. So he was taken to the hospital, and also her current boyfriend was injured, but not seriously. And the ex-boyfriend was taken by ambulance to the hospital in Riverton and then flown out of the area. So this must be with serious injuries. So this must be like way out there in the country somewhere.
Go ahead.
Boyfriend Hutchinson said was not armed at the moment he was shot. The incident is under investigation, but in Wyoming, the use of force is justified in cases of self-defense. It is also to protect someone also in the immediate area who is believed to be in serious or mortal danger. So I was trying to picture this, right? So you have these two guys just going at it. I mean, he was beating up her current boyfriend, and she retrieved her pistol and shot him. I don't think that's an easy feat, never done it, but I can only imagine with the adrenaline and everything else going. That was strong of her. She was a brave woman to do that, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating that stalkers, there are people, both men and women, that think, you know, if they can't have the other person, then nobody can. You know, and they get this superior attitude. I don't know if there's like a psychological profile or term for this, but this is where the stalkers and the crazy people come from. Most people don't get violent, but some do. And you know, why would anybody think they have the right to beat up the next person that somebody is with simply because they're not with them? And probably the reason they dumped that person was because they were dangerous. You know, and so this phenomenon is kind of crazy. I mean, stalkers are dangerous people. You know, people that want to commit violence just because they don't get their own way. It's the most incredibly selfish thing I've ever heard. But it's there.
Yeah.
You know? So you have to protect yourself. And you know, I'm surprised they didn't mention the story too. You know, was the gun lawfully purchased? They always seem to do that in the liberal states. The gun was lawfully purchased and lawfully registered. You know, totally dismissing the fact that this woman had to save the life of her boyfriend and probably herself too. Bianchi.
Right. And like you said, I mean, what you're talking about happens more often than you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that was kind of the case in my incident. But the term I use is they're just crazy. They're just crazy. You said, what's the technical term? They're just crazy. Yeah, it's like that. If I can't have you, nobody can mentality. And I'm not sure where that comes from.
Yeah. What kind of arrogance and psychotic arrogance? Bianchi?
Yeah, they jump on the new boyfriend because he wouldn't be there if she didn't permit it. So he's not there on false pretense. This is what she wants. So he wants to take away her choice because her choice wasn't him.
Yeah, the new boyfriend is happy too, apparently, because he's with the girlfriend. So, you know, and it's just – but, again, the people – you know, the ex-boyfriend goes after the new boyfriend. You know, it's like what? You know, or now do you go after his ex too? Are there reports on that or no?
No, it just shows that she went after, retrieved the firearm, and while the two were fighting. So, no, there's no direct. Well, he could have, but it's not in the article itself. But yeah, I don't understand what the mentality. Of course, a lot today's day and age. Sometimes I question a lot of the activities people are doing.
I think it's based on narcissism, because narcissism is the ultimate, you know, worship of yourself. That you are more important than anybody else in the world, and everybody has to, you know, sort of bend to your will. And these people, I don't think people are born necessarily with this, but they pick it up somewhere. You know, maybe it's in their own family, or they see, you know, the relationships with their parents or whatever it is. But there is a certain, you know, the most dangerous person, and, you know, you can talk more about this than I can if you want. It's up to you. But I think the most dangerous person, especially for women, are exes, you know, husbands, boyfriends. You know, so this is a, I don't know, it's like a possession thing. Guys say, well, you know, if you're with me once, you know, you're always mine. It's like, well, I don't think so. That's not how this works out.
Right. I think you're right when you said a possession. Lots of times you get in relationships and there are the people that think they possess you. And that was kind of the case where he started to getting really possessive and started following me and stalking me and wanting to where I was and everything. But I don't know if sometimes I wonder if they've always had that mentality or that personality. I don't know which one it is, a mental thing or a personality thing.
You know what it is? In some countries that is like that. I can name one. I'm not going to name it. But the United States, we look at it different. But in some country, your wife and your children is your property, even today. So
no, Muslim countries are like that. They have they call honor killings, which is one of the most ridiculously horrendous names. Something if a woman cheats on a husband, she gets killed. But if a man cheats on the wife, it's like, you know, another day in their life. It's a totally horrible standard. This is why
when we talk about bad situations
here, it's like, try the Muslim countries. Yeah.
Traditional culture has it. Without the inclusion of any religious concept in some countries. Now, you're right, in Muslim countries, yes, but in some traditional countries, your child and the child and the mother is your property. And the woman would say that. So I can see where that comes from. But like you say, here in the United States, a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. Are there divorces in those countries under those cultures or no?
Yes, it is. It's divorces.
Okay, so if you have a divorce, can the women divorce the men? Or is it only the men divorce the women?
Yeah, it's a process. It's just not you just up and go and file papers like you do here and pay a fee. But
yeah, get a lawyer. Get a lawyer, take the kids, take the house. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, Shirley. I'm just, you know.
No,
that's on family court. Yeah. Okay. Well, the reason I'm asking is simply because, you know, if that's the case, if women can leave, you know, is it a culture where the guys say, no, you can't? You know, and so it's a very interesting. Let's get Jim in the conversation. Jim called in a little bit early for his report. Jim, what's your take on all this? I think I surprised.
Sorry about that. I couldn't get my mic back unmuted.
Oh, okay. Well, you're back now.
I'm going to sit and listen because I joined in very late in this conversation. So
okay.
I'm not sure where you guys have gone with this. So
well, just hang out. Join in when you feel like it.
That works both ways, too, Greg, because we had a congressperson in the 1st Congressional District of Missouri, Lacey Clay. He's divorced his wife, and the only way she knew it, the children read about it in the paper and told their mothers.
Wow. That's scary. Well, you know, and we've done several and we've done a lot of shows on family court issues. We've got some horrible stories. We've got two women who were arrested at gunpoint for protecting their kids, and family court is notorious for awarding kids to the wrong parents so they can maintain conflict so they can keep making money. You know, it's a huge racket. So I'm not sure how this is going to play out in relationships, but these stalking situations, I think they're based on narcissism. I think the people, they're so important that whatever they want, they can have. And if they can't, nobody else can either. And they think of people as possessions. And you do not want to be associated with those people, you know, under any circumstances. And I think that's kind of where it goes. Shirley, what do you think?
And but you don't always know right off the start
They're the nicest people.
And sometimes
when you meet
it progresses along.
Yeah, so it's hard.
It's hard in that case, and that's why I think it's very important that women are able to defend themselves. You know, my choice is to be able to carry and defend myself with a firearm. But remember, last week we talked about the effects of a person that has to take a life to save a life, to save their life,
and what that
does to their mind. Well, can you imagine? Because I've gotten a couple books. I'm doing a little research on that. I don't have anything to report at this time. But can you imagine on top of that, knowing the person? I mean, that's got to complicate things even more mentally, what you're going to be going through, because not only did you have to defend yourself, whether you took a life or harmed somebody, but then you also know the person. I mean,
well, had a relationship with the person. Let's put another layer on it. Yeah.
I know, and I remember when I was trying to fight my way out in the relationship that I was in and being held, and that was still in the back of my mind that this person, you know, I know this person, what, and it was like I couldn't believe what was going on, and I think part of me didn't go all out at times. I just second-guessed myself. I find I second-guessed myself a lot on the whole situation and how I tried to get out of it, but... Yeah, go ahead. Who is going to be talking? I'm sorry.
Yeah, Pianki.
Well, you made mention of this case in Wyoming, but here's something. You, an instructor, that you may want to instruct your trainees. What if they come upon a incident where you got two people fighting, beating the hell out of each other? You don't know who's the attacker and who's the victim. So at that point, would you not constrain both of them? Put both of them under the gun and tell them to lay down until let the police come and work it out?
Well, I think it definitely, in a situation where you don't know what the whole story is and you're not a part of it, you're just kind of seeing the after effects, you can't just determine who's doing what, you know, who it's seen who. First and foremost, it's called 911. And then that's another thing that you see a lot of. You know, everybody's taking a video with their phone. Nobody's trying to help anybody. Everybody wants to video it. And I'm like, oh, you know, something's just wrong about that. It's kind of like videoing a train wreck, but you're not going to help the person. So, you know, if you have multiple people around, you can maybe handle the situation and get the people off each other. But I don't know. It's kind of like, I guess Jim could talk about this, law enforcement coming in. They don't know who did what to whom. They don't know.
They handcuff both of them.
Yeah, they see one person holding two people with a gun.
If you in a car.
Now what?
Yeah.
The good person.
If you in a car and someone is breaking in the car, when do you shoot? Do you shoot before they break in? Because if they get the door open and all of a sudden your gun don't work, wouldn't it be better to find out the gun don't work while they're on the outside trying to break in rather than got the door open, getting ready to come out?
Another reason for quality firearms properly maintained. Jim, can I get on this?
That was a good commercial.
Well, as a radio guy, it just comes out. I can't help it.
Yeah, so Pianki does make, you know, somewhat of a valid point. I will tell you, in the state of Florida, you cannot use deadly force until the person has actually entered your vehicle. So you are allowed to, if someone forcibly enters your vehicle while you are in it, you can assume that they mean to do to cause death or great bodily injury to you, and you can use deadly force to prevent them from doing that. But you can't do that until they have forcibly entered the vehicle.
So they have to, like, be climbing in your window or at least halfway in their window or something like that, you know, where they're actually,
or,
you know,
have pulled the door open or have broken the window out. They have to have done something where they have forcibly entered the vehicle.
Yeah, there's a video I just saw. This guy keeps knocking on this window of this woman. And he's like, open the window. You know, I got to talk to you. You know, and eventually it turns out that he says, yeah, you dropped your cell phone. Yeah, here it is. You know, it was a nothing thing. But he looks like perp. It's like he's trying to, and the woman is sitting there, oh, God, what do I do? What do I do? I don't want to drive away. I might hit him, you know, all this other kind of stuff. And it's the most frustrating video to watch. And the guy, you know, eventually, I mean, it was all staged, obviously. But he says, yeah, you dropped your cell phone back there. Here it is. And, you know, I said, oh, I was just trying to give it to you. What are you all worried about? But the way they portrayed it, the way they made this thing look, the guy, you know, was in the hoodie. You know, he's putting tape on the window so he can pull it down to give the to give them their cell phone back. But you don't know that till the very end of it. So you don't know what people are going to do. You don't know. But you can assume if they're trying to rip your door open or smash your window that it's not good. That's what I would think. But until then, you know, we're just trying to wash your window.
Yeah, you're right about the washing, but hang on.
Yeah, squeegee people are bad.
They're using the crowbar, and they're tearing the hell out of your car trying to get in. Hey, mm-hmm. you got to wait till they do get in? And like I said before, hell, suppose your gun misfires mm-hmm. once they're in there. Now you're really subjected to some something. But you mentioned those windshield wipers. Those kids at the corners, they get pissed off because you don't want to pay. Then they grab a hold of the top part of your windshield. Not your windshield, but your window, and they break it out. So do you shoot them?
Well, there's a good question. You know, if you present a firearm and say, if you break my window open, I'm going to shoot you, even though they have not physically broken your window, but you haven't physically fired either. I think it's a Jim Dykes question. Jim, can you threaten with deadly force to prevent them from breaking into your car? He's muted. Was it coffee time? Did you leave?
Yeah, no, I just, my mic was giving me, my mic was giving me some problems.
Here's what I do.
In Florida, at least, the answer is no, you can't do that. You can't threaten someone with deadly force until you are authorized to use deadly force.
So you can't put your gun on the dash and say, I really don't want you to try and break in my window. Someone's banging on your window, but they haven't physically broken anything.
You can't do that anyway because we don't allow open carry in Florida.
So you can't even show your firearm to defend yourself to prevent an incident. That's weird. Shirley?
Yes.
What do you mean you're authorized to use deadly force? I don't understand what that meant.
So unless there is a reasonable threat of death or great bodily injury to you, you can't use deadly force. You can't display a firearm until you've reached that threshold. So
right, I get that, but so if someone is trying to get in my car, and well, if they have a firearm, that's different, totally, right? They're not in my car yet, but they're drawing a firearm.
Right, then they're definitely a threat, and all of it's going to be situationally dependent, right? If someone's banging on your window and telling you they need to talk to you and you're scared, you can't point a firearm at them. You know,
they're not drive away, right?
Well, and they're not necessarily a threat. There are 100 different reasons they could be banging on your window saying they need to talk to you.
Yeah. They might think you're the Uber driver, you know, and you don't want to kill somebody over something like that. Yeah.
Or you may have left your coffee sitting on top of the car and it's still sitting up there. I'm trying to tell you, hey, you're about to lose your coffee all over the back of your car.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You never know.
Yeah. And I'm going to add something because it happened around here. You've got to watch out for road rage, especially in this area, which is supposed to be one of the safest areas in the country, I guess. I don't know if it's country or state of Florida. But on the interstate, mm-hmm. I'm not sure what happened as far as this guy just started getting into road rage, and he pulled over. I think both cars were pulled over for some reason. I don't know if he got hit. But the guy comes out shooting at the other guy and then takes off. The guy he was shooting at didn't get hurt. He just ducked down, and then the guy takes off. And I'm like, wow, that's just the mentality, the stress. I don't know if it's the stress or what's going on with people, but road rage is you got to really watch it around here.
But,
I'm sure it's everywhere.
But the thing is, if you in your car, ma'am, and some idiot is – you can't hear them, but you can see the actions that they have. They open up your door. You're right there. You don't have time to go over to your glove box. You don't have time to reach over to your purse. You're right there, and they have you. And what do you describe? It looks like it's going to be intimate danger or bodily harm. Hey, you're a meager female, and the slightest squeeze of their big, burly hands can hurt you and leave permanent damage. No, I think you have a right to shoot them.
And Pianchi, at the end of the day, the point at which you have the right to either display the firearm or not is what a judge or 12 jurors say, which is sad. I mean, the law is what it is, and I can tell you about some case law that might be relevant to it. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to explain, and they're going to look at the totality of the situation. And to paraphrase, I think it was Chris Rock who said it, you end up having your guilt or innocence decided by 12 people who weren't smart enough to get out of jury duty.
That's the scariest thing ever all day. I want to get back to Shirley's situation here, because it's fascinating, because now you've got, I'm thinking of like, you know, rape cases where the defense attorney has to say, well, you were consenting, you know, this was, you brought this on, and the old, you were dressed this way, so you're asking for it kind of thing. All this horrible stuff we've hopefully gotten out of the courts. But in a relationship, you know, I mean, would the defense attorney of the person who was, well, of course they were killed, but the family comes after the woman and says, well, you never liked him. You know, you've hated him all this time. You know, you induced this, you made him attack, you know, your new boyfriend, you know, whatever. I mean, what kind of protections are there for women in situations like that?
That's a good question. It's awful to say, because it's used the other way too.
Absolutely.
Women, you know, they cry rape, and that's what they just are mad. They're just, it's like revenge. And,
red flag laws are notorious for that, for false accusations.
Exactly.
That's why they're illegal. Okay,
and
go
I
for
actually,
it.
I've heard about someone that had to go through something like that. But the thing was, they had broken up for a couple years. And I'm like, how do you come back with that after a couple years being broken up and then have his firearms taken away? So it's,
no, women can do the same thing. If I can't hit you, nobody can too. You know, they may not be violent necessarily, but the courts are there, and the false accusations work a lot of times. Yeah.
That's why the red flag law was really, really crazy, because people can just, I'm mad at you, so I'm just going to turn you in, and then you spend all this time and money trying to get your firearms back when there was nothing justified about the whole thing to start with.
Yeah. Let's get your contact stuff. I'm going to move over to Jim here in a little bit, but just in case, you know, you have to leave at any time. But of course, stick around, because Fridays are fun around here, so you're always welcome to stay. But I want to make sure we get your contact info in at this time.
Yeah, because I am going to have to drop off. I do have to go teach another class.
Okay.
So if you're interested in getting involved with DC Project or want to get a hold of me, you can just go to dcproject.info. And go to the information and fill out a little questionnaire, and that'll get back to me. If you want to make a donation, you can do so there. And like I said, if you're in D.C. on September, what day did I say that was?
16th.
From 1 to 4. We'll be rallying at the Capitol. Come join us. And that's it. That's my report, D.C. Project, Women in Gun Rights, right? For Action Radio Group. Have a great weekend.
And if you can talk to Diana, like I say, I'd love to get her opinion on how much you can lobby and talk about some of our bills. And because you write some interesting stuff around here. Thank you, Shirley. Appreciate it. Super. Let's get to Jim. Out of the forests of Virginia to the swamps of southern Florida comes a great man who carries a big gun, probably a Desert Eagle 50 caliber. He served our nation in the military. He protected the citizenry in law enforcement, and now he is a director of Florida Carry, trying to make the Second Amendment, as written, a reality for all Americans. He is Jim Dice with the Second Amendment Report for Action Radio. You know, you raised an interesting thing earlier, that open carry, that pretty much eliminates brandishing laws because you're already carrying openly. You know, can you point at your gun and say, you know, don't mess with me? I mean, you know, this is going to bring up a whole bunch of interesting new law, won't it?
No, because under the current laws for aggravated assault, you know, when you point a weapon at someone without justification, you've committed an aggravated assault.
But what if you leave it in your holster? You're just carrying a weapon openly.
Right, yeah. And, yeah, you're right. Know. So in the holster, then it would be fine.
Okay.
Well, isn't your car your castle?
It is.
Well, if
point.
I'm in my house, I can point my gun. Here goes somebody walking down the street, and I'm looking at my window. I'm pointing my gun at them.
Actually, you can't in Florida.
Well, then that needs to be changed.
There is a limit to how much your castle is your castle.
So we're limited castles here? We have some castle appropriation going on that I didn't know about?
Yeah, I'm actually fine with having a law that says you can't point a firearm at someone who's outside your house from inside your house because, you know, you're already violating one of the rules of firearm safety by doing that. There's no reason for you to be sitting in your house pointing weapons at people who are, say, on the sidewalk or in the streets or...
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Well, no, I agree. But if you got your gun, if somebody's outside, you got a glass door, and you walk up to the door, somebody's trying to break in, you got your gun in your hand. You're in your house. And
now,
then
they can say
anything. Wait a minute. They can say anything because the third person is not there. They can say, well, they pointed. What are you doing? Well, you in your house. So that's your castle. You should have a right to do everything you want. You could take the gun and twirl it on your finger like Butch Cassidy.
Now, you could do that. You could twirl a gun on your finger in your castle all day, you know, all you want. And if someone's trying to break into your home, then that's something different. Because you are allowed to use deadly force if someone has broken into your home. So, you know, I think if someone were in the process of trying to break in your home and you pointed a weapon at them, I think you would be fine.
Well, there was a case that brought this dimension to me. This woman was in a car, and this fool was outside with a crowbar opening the door, and he got the door open, and some reason or another, he left. But if I was her, I would have shot him. Hell, he's got the door open. He's got a crowbar in his hand. So what are you going to do? Wait till he conk you across the head or wait till your gun go click, 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 and nothing happens?
I agree with you. If you're in a car and someone pries the door open with a crowbar, I would definitely use deadly force to stop them. No doubt in my mind.
You know, one of the problems with this is, and we'll get to your stuff in just a second here, is the practicality. Because most times when you carry a concealed firearm, if it's on your belt, either inside the waistband or outside, it's in a place where the seatbelt has it locked in. You can't get to most holsters when you're in your car. Do you recommend cross draw or two holsters? Or what's the practical way to deal with this situation?
So there are a few practical ways. I carry in my vehicle, and I'm in a pickup truck, so I've got a little more room in mine.
Of course you are.
because I'm going to do nothing to break the stereotype here.
Yeah, no, that's why I made you the Western theme. I figured you'd be, you know, imagining yourself riding up on a horse, you know, before you give your report. I mean, I have my fun.
So I carry in a fairly high riding inside the waistband holster on my right hip. And mm-hmm. my seatbelt actually does not hinder a draw when I'm in my vehicle. If you have a seatbelt that does do that, I know of people who actually put their weapon in a sling bag, like you can wear on your back, one of the little kind of oblong-shaped sling bags in a holster in there, and mm-hmm. they just sling it around to the front. And so it's on your chest, and that makes things very easy. If something looks like it's not right, you simply unzip the sling bag, and then it's right there. You can reach in and draw from across your chest pretty easily from one of those.
Yeah, I'm thinking shoulder holsters, cross draw holsters, or there's some like magnetized things where you can actually stick it to your dash. I guess it's exposed at that point, but
right.
You can reach
it. Yeah, so you can't do that in Florida. If it can be seen from outside the vehicle, then
that doesn't apply. Okay.
It is openly carried.
Okay. When are you going to fix that? What are you going to fix this open carry law?
Since you bring that up, Greg.
Which I did.
We actually have had a a case that's been going slowly through the courts challenging the open carry law, and it's in state court in Florida. And we ended up having to go after the ban on open carry of long guns because we had a terrible decision by the state Supreme Court a few years ago that upheld the ban on the open carry of handguns.
We had a Supreme Court a few years ago, too. So,
right, we did. And this was the state Supreme Court, but we had a terrible state Supreme Court, too. However, as that has been going through this past weekend, we had someone up in your area of the state who was running for county commissioner in Escambia County. And I don't know if you
saw this or not.
Stanley McDaniels, who decided that it was the 4th of July and by God, this open carry law is unconstitutional. And went out with a copy of the Constitution and started filming himself while he was open carrying a firearm and got himself arrested. So now we actually have a plaintiff for an open carry case challenging handgun, the restriction on open carry of handguns. So we've actually been in contact with he has a I think he has a court-appointed attorney, but we've been in touch with them about assisting on his case, and
I'll bring him on the show.
We'll see if
he actually
just recently bonded out of jail, so I think he's pretty busy right now.
We've had calls from jail before. We had Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the Oath Keepers, called us from the Oklahoma federal prison because Jonathan Mosley, our legal reporter, was representing him. So we've got I think three conversations from prison with Stuart Rhodes. So yeah, you can call us. I don't care if he's in jail or not. That's no Bounded Action Radio.
So our hope is with this case we can get it to the appellate court level where we can actually challenge this. So we will attempt to get the trial court judge, based on the recent Supreme Court ruling, to say that there is binding precedent within the state of Florida from the Supreme Court. However, this is and I think the wording they have to use, that it's a matter of great public importance. If he does that, then it will automatically go to the appellate court for decision. Even if he rules against it and says, I have to abide by the precedent of the state Supreme Court, if he declares that it's of great public importance, it will automatically go to the appellate court. And so we're hoping to get it at the appellate court.
So we can get open carry, not because a bill was passed by the legislature, but because the Constitution demands it.
Exactly.
Fine with me. I'm there.
And we're still pursuing the other case that we had to go at it from the long gun angle. So now we have two cases working in Florida courts challenging the ban on open carry. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, sounds good. What other news do you have? Good news, bad news? What do you got?
So I guess the biggest news since I've been on is that states, liberal anti-gun states, are doing what we assumed they would do. And doubling down on their anti-gun views and laws and basically ignoring Supreme Court's recent decision. So New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, a bunch of states are doubling down. New York has passed and a law that I can't imagine how in the world it's going to be found to be constitutional, and they've already had a couple of groups that have filed lawsuit against them, and the bill actually just got passed. There was a candidate who is running for office that filed a case. Gun Owners of America has filed a case against New York for their new law. So their new law does an awful lot of things
you should describe some of them for people just to know how bad this is, because it's really bad what they want to know.
So a few of the things that this new New York law does, because you have to have objective criteria. You can't be a may issue state. There has to be an objective criteria that everyone can meet, and if they meet that criteria, then you must issue them a permit. Mm-hmm. So New York has decided that in order to get a permit in New York, and these are just some examples of what you'll have to do, you will have to give the person who is granting the license the names and contact information of relatives and cohabitants so that they can be interviewed to find out if you somehow should not have a firearm. You are required to give them a list of your usernames and passwords for various social media accounts so that they can scrub your social media accounts to see if there's something that they think would make you unfit to be able to use a firearm. You have to provide 4 character references. And these 4 character references, I think, have to attest in writing and I think under oath that you, the applicant, has not engaged in any acts or made any statements that suggest that you are likely to engage in conduct that would result in harm to yourself or others.
Oh, I'm just laughing too. I mean, this is hysterical. I mean, it's easier to get yourself on the New York, mayor's ballot than it is to get a gun permit.
Right. And then that same bill puts in place a laundry list of prohibited places.
See, that's another big point too. And I want to get Pianki back in the conversation as well on this. But they've basically prohibited it everywhere. You know, schools, restaurants, shops, any kind of business, any within thousands of feet of it, all government buildings, all, you know, it's everything but private residences. And even then, you know, they have restrictions. This is a huge list.
It is. And my favorite place that they listed in the bill is, and this is a direct quote from the bill, the area commonly known as Times Square.
Yeah, but they did businesses, churches, restaurants. Yeah. They did bars. Well, I understand bars for the alcohol. Even in Florida, you can't sit at a bar, you know, with a gun and drink. But you certainly can in the booth, you know. But drinking a gun.
This is why.
Yeah, go ahead, Pianki.
That's why you had Amber in last week, and I hope she comes in today.
Well, she's doing a report at the top of the hour. Yep, after Derek.
Any person, I hope she's listening to what you're saying. Any person that's applying to or contemplating on holding a position, a government official, or even any other position, that they would have to have taken and passed a constitutional course, a course on the U.S. Constitution and those other documents too. Because apparently the people that's coming up with these ideas, they don't know what it is that they probably swore to protect and defend.
Yeah. I don't think Jim heard Amber. Amber Kemper is a 17-year-old high school graduate who proposed a bill that anybody running for Congress has to pass the citizenship test that immigrants have to pass, like me. And I thought it was a fabulous bill. So we had her on last week. Was it last week or the week before? Maybe even the week before, talking about her bill. And Pianki and I were so impressed, and Josie was impressed too, that I invited her to do a regular feature, do a constitutional report. And so she'll be on at the top of the hour. So hopefully you get a chance to listen to that. But she's amazing. Yeah.
It should go beyond running for Congress now, whether you're running for state legislation position, whether you're running to be a professor in a school. That should be applied to any place that you're going to be instructing or influence the public.
Well, tell Amber when she gets here, or you can put a comment on her bill. That's a good way to do it as well. Definitely do that. But Jim, so check the podcast if you can't stick around or if you can't listen live. But this is pretty cool. So we have our own constitutional report now. And I'm trying to get more younger folks involved in the show anyway. But it seems like the people that, like Christian Frenette, who started on the show when he was 11, started doing chess reports because he says teenchess.com. They're all homeschooled. It's fascinating. The other thing that's interesting is that when I went through my citizenship test, I don't remember them ever talking about the Second Amendment. So I should talk to Amber about that too. Jim, are you aware of that? That they test the First Amendment. They test due process and things like that. They test you on your knowledge of the preamble and the basic workings of government. But I don't remember them ever mentioning the Second Amendment in my citizenship interview or anything about it at any point during the process. That's
interesting. I don't know, because I've actually never seen the citizenship test. I've seen a few sample questions here and there, but haven't
you know,
seen.
That might be something interesting for Florida Carry if they want to get involved in it. And I know it's federal, but it might be the gun groups might want to look into the citizenship test and find out whether or not educating people on the Second Amendment. I don't think that's changed. I'll bet you it hasn't, just because of government.
I am curious to see what the courts would rule on a bill that would require someone being elected to Congress to take and pass a test on the Constitution, because there's nothing in the Constitution that lists that as a requirement for being a legislator.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could probably do that.
Me and Greg has to be able to pass the weather portion. Nothing in the Constitution that says that me and Greg have to be able to identify clouds in the sky when we get our pilot's license. So, you can put whatever you want in there.
But the Constitution also doesn't say these are the requirements to be a pilot. It does say these are the requirements to be a member of the House of Representatives or to be a member of the Senate, the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. States can probably do whatever they want.
The Congress could pass this as a rule, you know, because they have rules on ethics, they have rules on all kinds of things that aren't in the Constitution. That's just the behavior of Congress. And so they could easily pass this bill as a rule, and if it was checked constitutionally, that would be very interesting. I would love to see them defend not knowing enough about the Constitution that an immigrant has to know. That's going to be an interesting argument.
I would agree that the Congress probably could require new representatives to take a class given within the Congress on the Constitution, because like you said, that's kind of the rules of how they operate. But I don't think you could require that in order for someone to be elected to Congress.
Well, let's find out. I think it's worth trying. I think it's
be elected, but to register to run for Congress. Once you met all the stipulations, then okay, you're good to run. But no, if you don't meet them all, it's just like anything else. If I hire a welder and he can only weld vertically, well, he's no good for overhead. What I'm going to do, fire him? He's got to be able to do everything that we put out there for as a criteria.
But again, I go back to the fact that the requirements to be a welder aren't delineated in the Constitution. Representative are delineated in the Constitution. It says these are the requirements for you to be a legislator.
Now here's what you do, though. See, so this is where we'd use the bills as an education process, and we could guilt them into it. And they say, well, we can't make this a law. Let's say the court rules against us, right? They say, well, we can't make this a law, but do you want somebody running for Congress that can't even pass the citizenship test that any immigrant has passed? You know, we can use this as an educational tool.
Then
it doesn't have to pass.
Then the voters can make a decision.
Exactly.
Do they want to have this lame brain as your representative, and they don't know the Constitution?
And what does it say about Congress that they'll accept members that don't know the oath they're swearing to? You know, so there's a lot of ways we can use this. Bills, see, everybody thinks that you're not successful unless you pass a bill. We can do all kinds of things here and not pass bills and have huge effect. You know, first of all, changing the public debate, public perception, you know, guilt for people running for Congress and in the other office, all the way down to local government. You know, so there's the possibilities here really are endless. Anyway, we got Derek coming in soon, so I'll make sure we cover what Jim wanted to cover.
Yeah, we're doing well. We've covered most. I guess one more interesting Florida story, just because, you know, Florida is Florida. So if you're looking for interesting stories, Florida is always going
to
pop up.
Well, we're such a diverse state. You know, we've got everything from New Jersey communists to, other states, you know, the Montanans that want a warmer weather. we got a crazy state here. It's great.
And apparently, you know, there's all kinds of excitement going on in Escambia County, because this is another story out of Escambia County, where a Florida homeowner had three people enter his home, one of them with a firearm, late at night on July 7th. And the homeowner, I guess, pulled out a handgun from his waistband, and for some reason, instead of engaging them with his handgun, he dropped it and ran and retrieved what the article calls an AK-47 style rifle.
something bigger than a handgun, right? Whatever that
and,
is. Yeah.
And he actually grabbed that while one of the suspects who, one of the two who wasn't armed, picked his handgun that he had dropped up off of the floor. And the homeowner began firing at them, and they fled. And I guess there's a fairly decent sheriff in Escambia County, because
he was very
quick to come out and say that the homeowner absolutely will not be facing any charges. Two of the suspects were quickly arrested, and the third one was later found with a gunshot wound to his head, which apparently was not a fatal gunshot wound. So I'm guessing it was just a grazing shot.
That's lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, if you get shot with a 7.62 round from an AK-47 and in the head, and you end up not having it be a fatal shot, that's a lot of luck on your side.
I had an instructor who was a Vietnam combat person who took an AK-47 round, I think, to the calf, and you know, it did amazing damage. You know, it's permanent scarring and the whole bit. And so I understand, you know, it's like we see these things. One of the things we talked about, you know, back in my gun store days was wound ballistics, you know, so that's something we may want to get into at some point. Yeah, Pianki?
Yeah, sheriffs need to take the test too. Apparently that one may know or may have to have to take the test. He had the right call.
Yeah, I don't know if it's Morgan or Simmons has done so. Both of them have been on my show. So I'm right next door to Escambia County here in Santa Rosa County, and I've had our Sheriff Johnson on the show too.
They're all three of them great. Simmons is the one who's there now.
Simmons, okay. I should get him back on the show. I'll see if I can get him on your report because Simmons, he's pretty cool. And they're very good about that. And Sheriff Johnson here in Santa Rosa County, you know, he still does regular patrol. And I've told the story before that if he pulls you over and you have a steel carry permit and you're not carrying, he yells at you. It's like, what's wrong with you? Why are you not carrying your gun? What's your problem? You're un-American. He's really great about that kind of stuff. And you don't hear that. You know, you're not going to hear that out of Alameda County, Bay Area, you know, where you can't get a carry permit, you know. So the last question I guess I have is these may issue states, they're, you know, they're certainly not going with the spirit of the Supreme Court decision, and they're actually violating the intent and the, you know, the letter of it too. We knew they were going to do this. This is entirely predictable. Is the Supreme Court going to try and enforce this somehow? I mean, I don't think they can. What are the penalties for violating, you know, the constitutional rights of people by basically making up almost the same law they had before, which is going to be ruled unconstitutional, but it's going to take time. So they get all that time, they still get to stay in charge while they're doing something illegal.
Right. So I think what you're going to see is, like you said, there's really not a lot of enforcement mechanisms that are out there. So mm-hmm. the states will pass these illegal and clearly unconstitutional laws. They'll go through the court system. They'll end up back up at the Supreme Court, which will mm-hmm. rule them unconstitutional. And what they will basically do is they will try to find many different ways of preventing people from having firearms. So, you know, presumably mm-hmm. this New York law will get up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will say, this is unconstitutional. You can't do all of these laundry list of things that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And so New York, being New York, will go back and they will write a different set of restrictions with some other reasons of how they can, that's just as bad, but hasn't been ruled on by the Supreme Court yet. Now what hopefully will happen is you will have a decent federal judge that will get this and will rule it quickly unconstitutional and put a stay on them from enforcing any of these laws that are in this and say this entire law is unconstitutional and put a temporary injunction in to prevent them from being able to enforce any of those laws.
Mm-hmm. And this is a good example of where you have modified my opinion on judicial review, that this is the logical thing for judges to do because it's a restriction on government. And they're not making a new policy. They're basically, you know, suspending one that violates Supreme Court opinion. And so that to me makes a lot of sense. If that judge then goes on to say, New York, this is how you're going to implement the new law, that's when they would have crossed the line as far as I'm concerned. But it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. These people in New York is making up the state house. Where do they come from? What's their background?
Well, that's the other thing, too. New elected officials would change it as well, yeah.
Yeah, where are these people coming from, Jim?
So the problem is, you know, in New York, you have upstate New York, which has some fairly conservative people in it. Mm-hmm. But most of the citizens of New York live in and around New York City. So you're going to have more representatives who are New York City dwellers and are very liberal and tend to be very anti-gun, and that's who they're going to elect. The legislators who they elect go to Albany, and they care about getting reelected. So they're going to do what those voters in New York City want them to do, even if it's unconstitutional.
Yeah, California has the same problem. You know, if you're
and
in
Illinois
the middle
has
of the
same
state,
problem.
Where else, Jim?
And Illinois has the same problem.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because
the
Chicago is so big.
Yep. Yep. California, I remember
they
well.
Did have a rash of stabbings? Was there a rash of stabbings in New York just recently? Or seemingly I've heard. What are they going to do? Go out the knives next and sharp pointed sticks?
Yes,
yeah,
but they always,
I guess.
Now, they go after what people can use to resist government tyranny. That's why they go after the guns. That's why knives, chainsaws, hammers, SUVs, you know, all these things that are dangerous, poisons, ANFO, you know, ammonium nitrate fertilizer, those things, you know, they're regulated, but there's never the same thing. It's the guns. And the JPFO, and I'll get to Derek's online, I'll get to him, but Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership has a lot of documentation that the single most effective weapon against a tyrannical government for a regular citizen is a semi-automatic rifle, like an AK-47 or an AR-15. Not fully automatic, total waste of ammo, spray and pray, ain't going to happen. But a semi-automatic rifle of a medium caliber is the most effective weapon that the citizens of around the world can use against their government if that government becomes tyrannical. And what's the number one thing that our government wants to get rid of? What they call assault weapons, which are semi-automatic rifles, AR-15, AK-47 style rifles of medium caliber, you know, that they've demonized. And that's why they've demonized them.
And the thing about an AR-15, it can't be barreled where it shoots a 22 long rifle, which is good for squirrel hunting.
No, I never thought about that. It's a nasty looking gun, though, for squirrels. Squirrels might get offended. Let's get to the actually, wrong thing there. Jim, contact information, then let's get to Derek. And, of course, you're welcome to stick around.
Of course. So, Jim Dykes from Florida Carry. You can find Florida Carry on the web at floridacarry.org. You can reach me directly, jim@floridacarry.org.
Yep, Port Open Carry in Florida. And for our Canadian, Australian, and English listeners who are growing a lot, in our audience here, we need to work with you guys to get you a Second Amendment that you don't have right now. All right, let's talk money. Money. What is it? How does it work? How do you get it to work for you? So many choices. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, commodities, and then there are the markets. Oil, gold, manufacturing, trade, energy, even government. To make sense of all the places your money can go, Derek Park of Edward Jones Financial Advisors joins us Fridays at this time to make sense of the markets and your money. And what should we talk about this week? Inflation? Saudi oil? Where should we go, Derek?
It's all here.
Yeah, sure is.
Well, anyway, right, Jim, we go. Derek is ready for us.
Yeah. Well, let's start with our report. And let's dig into it. We know the problems. I mean, they're so obvious. I mean, the economy is like the number one story right now. So, because they're botching it up so badly.
Well, the big dirty R word, in my personal opinion, is probably already here. You know, I mean, they're saying it. So, you know, the conditions have pretty much been met. You know, I mean, short of low unemployment, but that's not one of the conditions. High unemployment. I'm sorry, said that wrong. Unemployment is one of the factors. But as the economy continues to kind of crumble, you know, you start to hear people that aren't hiring. So unemployment is going to rise. So it's going to meet the criteria. So you'll be there.
So. Yeah, but it's interesting with unemployment. They consider people who are looking for work as what is unemployed. If you're not looking for work, if for whatever reason, you know, you've given up, you're living on something else, you've decided to do whatever, that's not counted. So unemployment can be artificially lowered because they're people that say, well, I'm not looking for work. I've had enough of work. You know, work doesn't work. You know, I'm just going to here and, you know, take welfare, you know? And this is why we should talk about, maybe we can get in this a little bit today, but there's like four or five different measures of unemployment. There's U1 through U6. I think they use U6, which is the most restrictive, narrow measure of unemployment, because it doesn't take into account long-term unemployed, doesn't take into account those who've decided to stop looking for work, yet they are during working age. I think, what is it they call it, the workforce percentage? What's that number?
Ooh, I don't know.
I think it's workforce percentage. In other words, the percentage of people who can work because they're between 18 and 65, and then the percentage of those who are 18 to 65 who aren't working. And that, I think, is the workforce participation rate. I believe that's what it's called. That's almost a more accurate measure of unemployment, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get the numbers, and we shall dive into them.
All right. Well, good morning, everybody. This is Derek Park of Ever Jones bringing you the Daily Financial Market Report. Markets stabilized on the day, with equity markets ending the day well off session lows as the NASDAQ ended modestly higher after being down over 1.5% earlier in the day. The financials, energy, and materials were the biggest laggards of the day, driven lower in part by weaker than expected bank earnings. Meanwhile, the U.S. dollar strength continues, with the DXY dollar index hitting a new high for the year, now close to 109. The dollar has been one of the most few assets that has seen positive returns this year as the flight to safety and trade in currency continues. As the Federal Reserve front loads rate hikes, the VIX volatility index moved lower today to 26 levels, still well below the highs it reached around 37 earlier this year. This indicates that the markets are not yet showing signs of panic, and the sell-off thus far remains orderly. The U.S. equities closed lower today, with the Dow Jones down 143 points, or 0.46%, to 30,630, and the NASDAQ closed up 4 points, or 0.03, to 11,251, and the S&P 500 closed down 11 points, or down 0.03, 37.90, and in the bond market, 10-year Treasury yields are trading at 2.96, higher by 0.05. In the commodity markets, the price of crude oil was down 20 cents, or 0.21, to $96.10, and the spot price of gold was down $28, or minus 1.62%, to $17.0740. This is Derek Park of Ever Jones, member SIPC. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
Okay, let's jump on the oil thing right away. First of all, thank you. But the oil price is below $100. It was like $108 last time we talked. Now it's $96. Demand driven? We're just not, you know, because of the recession, people aren't spending money. They're not taking their vacation. They're not, you know, going for the weekend at grandma's. There isn't the demand for oil, and that's why it's dropping. That's what I've heard.
So
we talked about
You have demand that is going down in anticipation of a recession, and then you have commodity traders that are also a small portion of that are trading the futures, which we already talked about. So that will drive the price down. But you know, that's not the predominance of it. You know, the good and the silver lining in this is, if we are, and they officially announce that we're in recession, which, like I said, my opinion, and I've talked about this before, I pretty much said we're probably already in it, and they just haven't announced it yet. But you know, if they do, That will drive down oil costs, which, you know, in turn will you know, allow transportation and food costs to come down, you know. So there is a little bit of silver lining in it.
It's interesting that it's the demand side of this equation that has lowered the price, because the supply is already down. I mean, it's being artificially restricted by government. And that's what, as demand lagged behind, you know, the demand didn't change. We were still at, you know, $1.87 demand with, you know, $4.50 prices. Like, well, wait a minute, that's not working. All of a sudden people, once they see the effect of that huge price increase, you know, over the course of the year and a half of the Brandon insurrection, have said, we can't do this anymore. So it's a fascinating thing. I mean, supply and demand works, whether people want it to or not, or even acknowledge it. But it's fascinating that the prices are coming down for all the wrong reasons. You know, the demand is down. People can't do the things they want to do. They can't travel where they want to travel. But the good effect is, like you say, that, you know, when the price of energy is down, the price of all the goods that require energy to get where they're going is down, because they don't have that extra component of transportation costs. So it's really quite fascinating, right, how this is working. Yeah.
Yeah.
Derek?
I mean, there's definitely many other factors. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, ideally, you know, I mean, you definitely want the government to continue raising rates. We need the housing market to come back. You know, so there's definitely more. Lumber costs are definitely on the way down. Material costs are following slow behind. The problem that some of the people from supplier standpoint is they're still not keeping up with the demand yet.
Okay.
You know, I know that sounds a little bit counterproductive from what I just said, but that's coming from a distributor that I know pretty well that says they don't have enough people to move the material. It's not necessarily that they can't get it. They're mm-hmm. having problems with drivers, you know, dock workers, things like that. You know, I mean, I guess we're running into more people that don't want to work. You know, I mean, they've got, you know, advertisements out there, but nobody's applying. You know, so
well,
not really sure
what
people are waiting for.
Well, and like in Florida, for example, I remember doing a big report on what I call the total revenue index, and it was my critique of the minimum wage. And because people said, well, you can't live on the minimum wage. And I said, well, people on the minimum wage are also getting Section 8 housing, food stamps, WIC, huge tax credits for kids, and all kinds of other things. So their total revenue index is way above the minimum wage. They're actually making a lot of money. So my question is the current situation still lopsided that you can make more money not working? Or can we create we're creating more of a situation where you make less money not working, but people are willing to do it because then they don't have to work because they're just lazy asses. Do you know where we stand on that in Florida?
Not really.
Okay.
You know, I mean, but I would say, I mean, it breathes really well. I mean, it's it does. You know, I mean, but where we're at, I mean, I wouldn't have any idea. But what I will tell you is, you know, a person that helps people manage businesses and runs, you know, their finance part of their business. You know, I mean, a lot of my businesses are all having the same problems. I mean, nobody wants to work, you know, I mean, so you know, I don't want to blame COVID, but you know, the fact that we ran unemployment for a year and a half, you know, mm-hmm. so you gave people a year and a half of free money to sit on their duff.
They got used to it.
You know, are you right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like now they have the expectation. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah.
You know, people, these are service industry jobs, you know, basic entry level things,
mm-hmm.
you know, that, you know, people now assume.
But they lead to management. They lead to promotion. They lead to district vice president. I mean, you know, a service job is a job only as long as you want it to be a service job. I mean, there's all kinds of places you can go.
Well, people's expectation now is they're going to make $600 a week because mm-hmm. that's what they were paid in unemployment. To you know, go flop whoppers and work you know, work a 30-hour work week with full benefits, you know what I mean? Like that's
doesn't
your
work
expectation.
Well, government.
Well, you and I both.
Yeah. Go ahead, Bianchi.
You know, another thing that with the Trump administration for businesses, that you was allowed to expense a major purchase that's going to be used in your businesses within a year. But the Democrats want to carry it out by 10 or 20 years, maybe not that far, but you can see the difference in the mentality. If I buy a crane, well, should I not be able to expense, write that off the year that I bought it? That way I can hurry up and recoup that money and hire more people and acquire more jobs?
I mean, the way that it is right now, the tax laws, you can. I mean, you know, as soon as you,
oh, no,
soon
you
buy something.
Yeah, with Trump, it is. But before him, you had to do it over a period of time.
And what they're talking about is depreciation. You know, that's a little bit different with writing it off into your taxes. Like, so without getting into a deep tax discussion, which technically I'm not supposed to do, that's not entirely correct. You know, but I mean, for intensive purposes, it was made more loose under the Trump administration. Yes.
Thank you.
It's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting. Getting back to unemployment, I was thinking as you're talking, there's like cultural unemployment and there's economic unemployment. You know, if there's a recession and people aren't hiring, I understand people not working, and they should definitely have unemployment if they had a job and were laid off. I understand that, especially if they're looking for work and counted as unemployed. But if you're culturally unemployed because you've just given up the idea of work because you're a lazy ass because the government paid you more money to not work, that's an entirely different phenomenon. So we've got like two things working here. And I know the government doesn't distinguish between cultural and economic unemployment because I just made it up just now. You know, so no, they're not going to measure it yet. But I think that's a real thing to consider. You know, and the government, when they give unemployment, they don't consider the economic. They consider how much money they can get away with giving so they can get more voters. Whereas when you get a wage, the company has to consider how much money are you generating for them. You know, if you generate, you know, $15 an hour, they're going to pay you 12. You know, because that's where the profit comes from. You know, they can't pay you as much as you generate for the company, or there is no company. So wages are very different. It's a different scale. It's what the company, you know, it's what you can bring to the company, whereas unemployment is what the government can bring to you. And there's a cultural misunderstanding of that. And the minimum wage as well. It's not based on what you need to live on. You know, it's based on the minimum to get you employed so then you can do more stuff. There's a cultural misunderstanding of unemployment and wages.
Yeah.
Derek?
Well, they don't understand because you got to be able to keep the doors open. You got to be able to keep the lights on, the telephone going. Mm-hmm. So, no, it's more than $15 an hour.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, if you go to your boss and say, look, I want to buy a new house, you need to give me a 30% raise. They're like, well, are you going to generate, you know, 35% more for the company? No. Well, then screw you. You know, because it's based on the company. But you can go to the government and lobby them and say, hey, we the United Workers of the World, you know, demand higher unemployment because, you know, it's fair. It's equitable. That's a whole different argument.
Right. Well, I mean, it's I mean, all in all, man, I mean, it's where we are right now is not really going to change until they go ahead and say, you know, I say they, you know, the government announces and the news go ahead and gets the fear out and says, we're in recession. You know what I mean? And I wish the news, the problem when they start announcing recession is it causes fear in everybody, right? It causes more fear because they start thinking 08, 09, the end is near. You know what I mean? People are going to start jumping off buildings. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Mass sell-off in the market. I mean, our company has pretty much already said, hey, if they do announce it, a lot of the trouble's already baked in. And I agree to that. I do. Okay. I mean, I agree that we've already experienced the losses that we do. The companies have already experienced the damage that they need. We do need energy costs to continue to go down. You know, energy costs go down. And then everything will regulate, right? And it's probably going to take another year for that to happen, right? So we've got another year of rebuilding. I would call it pain, you know, because I'll give you some other statistics on recessions in just a second. But, sure. You know, if the news goes ahead and does that but says, hey, listen, the trouble's already baked in, the recovery has now began, everybody would be like, oh, okay, no big deal, right? The news is going to be like,
recession's a necessary economic recovery measure. They could present it that way, too. And get rid of the fear.
Is. But well, they don't present it that way on the major news. They present it that way if you watch like a business channel, right? They'll be like, okay, but who watches the business channel? Nobody. Everybody watches the regular thing where it's all doom and gloom. You know, they'll just be like, well,
do.
Recession is here, you know, which means, you know, right, news is going to do what the news does, and it causes more panic. You know? So here's some interesting statistics on, you know, recessions. You know, since the market has been a real market, not the wild, wild west like it used to, because it's existed for 175 years. But, you know, it's for 100 years, we've had 13 recessions. Of the 13 recessions, only five have ended the year in negative numbers. And of those five, only two were extremely drastic, lasting more than a year. You know, so and that being the Great Depression in 08 and 09, right? All the rest of them were a 12 to 13 month cycle. All the rest of them pretty much ended the year in positive numbers. You know, so I'm not saying that we're going to be close to this, but you know, the case for it to be disastrous is very, very low. You know, in the market, from a market standpoint.
I think we are ready to, Derek. Popeye's chicken, 11 pieces, is right at $20. And you can't hold the grease.
Yeah. I mean, I feel you, man. You know, I saw a good thing floating around Facebook, and I mean, it says it was a fact check that says restaurant costs, you know, our cost for chicken was this.
Yeah, I saw that.
Now it's, I didn't go check on any of it, but by golly, it holds weight. You know what I mean? And you got people, 40% people's money on food is spent on eating out. That's actually a very high number. You know, I mean, for people that want to complain about finances and people that say, well, I don't have any money. And I mean, I do this for a living, you know? So, I mean, when I sit down with people to budget and they're like, well, I don't have this. And then I ask them how much they're eating out. I mean, if they're being honest, most people are like, dang, way too much. You know what I mean? Because I get it. They're busy. You know, I mean, that's their personal life. That's their personal time. And the thing that's most valuable to people is their time, right?
Yeah.
You know, so do they have the time to do the things? Well, they can go to a restaurant, have it cooked up in 15 minutes, eat it in another 20, and, man, they can be home and ready to do whatever they want to do. So they would almost rather spend triple the cost to do that, you know, 40% of the time. So that's kind of a staggering statistic.
Yeah, I bet it's lower in most other countries. We're probably the highest nation in terms of eating restaurants. I mean, it's great for the restaurant business. Yeah.
I would argue that. I really would.
Oh,
and let me
really?
Tell you, globally.
Okay.
You know, so, I mean, I've been to many different places. I mean, I'll tell you, for example, the first one to top of mind is South Korea. South Korea, their culture is very much set up to do a lot of eating out. You know, and you know, I mean, it's very inexpensive. I mean, you can eat a full meal. I mean, by golly, when I was there, I mean, like, minus inflation, I think everybody's experienced inflation, so let's take that out of the equation. I mean, you can eat a full meal, multiple course meal for, I mean, $7, you know, so, and I'm talking about that's like, you know, veggies, meats, breads, whatever. I mean, all kinds of stuff, you know, I mean, now they're very healthy people because of the way they eat, you know, and it's very small portions, and, you know, they expect that people aren't going to eat a lot. You know, and that's really what culture is designed for that. You know, the apartments are very small because space is very limited. It's very expensive over there unless you live extremely rural. And extremely rural doesn't exist too much in South Korea because the whole country is about the size of Illinois. You know, so, you know, that's one culture. I'll tell you that, like, when you get into you know, your downtown cultures in a lot of Arabic nations, it's the same thing. You know, I mean,
but I bet the portions are smaller. I bet the portions
are
smaller.
They are.
And they don't have the waste that we have. And how much of our restaurant waste is because the portions are too big, because Americans want big portions, even if they toss half of it out or take the doggy bag home, which is fine. I mean, I do that myself.
Oh, I agree with you. That is huge. I mean, I'll throw a restaurant out of the bus, man. That big experience since you're talking about it. We went to the Paula Deen's restaurant over in Foley, you know, over there in that amusement park they have. I had my best friend from college come down and we met his family over there. Yeah, I mean, really good food. It's all been cooking, you know, but you buy all these family sized portions and everybody eats from it. But, you know, we didn't know. We'd never been there. So we had a ton of food left. And they won't let you take the food. They won't let you box it up. And I asked the lady, I said, will not let you take it. I said, what do you do with it? And she looks at me with a dead stare and she says, I don't want to answer that question. You know, I mean, she was jokingly for it. And I'm like,
she did answer that question.
Me, dude. They could not box this stuff up, go donate it to a food bank. You know what I mean? Like give it a church. I'd be 100% okay with that. Right. You know, I mean, if they were comfortable accepting food that was on somebody else's plate, but not plate, but you know, on their table. But anyway, no, they're going to go throw it away, man. And I was like, holy crap. I said, I will never eat here again. Ever. Ever.
Well, your wife had to carry a big purse, wrap it up and put it in the purse.
Sneak it in.
Well, I would I would tell you a funny story about how we did get some of the stuff away, but, you know.
Don't give away your secret.
It is podcast. So think of the permanent record, Derek, before you say anything.
We were creative. But anyway, it's kind of sad. You're absolutely right about that, Greg. I mean, there is a lot of waste. I'll tell you, you know, even in my house, we're not very efficient with that. You know, I mean, we cook a meal, we save stuff, we try to eat a little bit of the leftovers, and there's things that end up in the trash. And I mean, I don't necessarily like it. I probably complain about it more than my family does. But I mean, that's just me, and I don't mind sharing
small
that
portions.
Example.
Yeah.
That's something we got to budget.
Yeah, there's very little waste. I'm a single guy, so I control all the food stuff. There's very little waste here because most of my stuff is, you know, raw fruits and vegetables and, eggs and fish and things that I'm making single portions for myself. There's almost never anything left over except like skin of, fruit and things like that. But for the most part, no. And you can change your diet. In fact, this might be a way for a lot of people to get more efficient, you know, in their own personal, in a recession, when money is, when everything's more expensive, if you can use your stuff more efficiently, combine your car trips, fill up your tires with air to the proper pressure, don't waste. There's like a lot of little things that people could do. We'd probably save tons of money, and the recession might actually have some discipline, and people can carry that onto when the times are good, and they'll have even more money, more disposable income. So there's a lot of things people can personally do with their own economy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, definitely being more fuel efficient, that's something, we as a society don't do very well. I mean, I don't drive a very fuel efficient vehicle myself, but I do keep my tires, and I try to get it as efficient as I possibly can.
Well, you don't have to. This is America. It's a free country. If you want to drive a Ford Focus, that's cool. But if you have here's something interesting too. You take a look. I did this study a while back too. You take a look at the utility. I broke down the cost of a Chevy Suburban versus a two-door Miata, and it actually works out that the Miata per person is more expensive. So having a big vehicle is not a problem. But if you have a huge pickup and you're the only one driving, you don't put anything in the back, that's a waste. Unless you really like it, in which case this is America, you can do that. But if you're a contractor, with all those tools and things, and it's a business vehicle, or if you have a Chevy Suburban and six kids per person, that cost is a lot less for that Chevy Suburban than it would be for four or five Ford Focuses or Miatas.
Well, you talk about the Ford Focus. My grandson got a Fiesta, and his manual automatic clutch went out. Mm-hmm. And they don't know when they're going to get the parts in. They say there's like 50,000 that's back
on. Stick shifts are more efficient. No, I think stick shift should be required in driver's ed. All people should learn to drive on a stick shift. Just like they should learn a tail dragger airplane.
It's
which
a
I
new
wish
design.
I did.
It's an automatic stick shift. But the thing is that they do go out. But they have a back order in the repair place. According to them, they have 50,000 pieces that's back ordered, and they don't know when they're going to get them in. So are these being made overseas in China?
Well, I want to ask you that question, but this goes to the cultural thing too. Kids don't want to work. Kids don't want to take 20 years to learn how to play guitar. Kids, we have a generation that has the instant gratification. If I can't look it up on Google, I don't want to spend the time to actually research something. And so we've got a cultural problem here. And this goes to learning stick shifts and everything else.
We got a cultural problem of people that always want to be right, and they'll die on the hill for it.
Explain.
You can clearly prove somebody wrong nowadays, and they'd be like, "Well, I wasn't entirely wrong." just say you're wrong and move on.
Oh, did you hear my mea culpa yesterday? You missed my mea culpa yesterday. Oh, Gregory Wrightstone was on, climate geologist. Apparently, that story that I broadcast earlier about abiotic oil, about the earth making oil and the mantle hydrocarbons getting together, was totally wrong. And so he corrected me, and I was like, hey, listen, go ahead, correct me. I don't care. I was wrong. I said it like 15 times. I was wrong. And I'll say it again today. Yeah. I was wrong. And I don't, and that's part of being in broadcasting. If you're wrong, say so. I don't consider a problem, a flaw or a fault or anything like that. It'd be a fault not to say I was wrong, but I really screwed up on that. So the earth doesn't make oil the way I thought it did. The abiotic theory does not work. So now that we got that corrected, we can get back to business. But
it's also not fossil fuels though, right?
That's true.
No,
it actually is algae mud. Well, here's something new too. I read this in the petroleum things. They're basically growing algae to make liquefied synthetic fuel. Do you know anything about that?
I don't. I mean,
yeah, that's been going on for a long time.
I've read that the fossil fuel theory was completely wrong, and I've read that, like you said, it came from some type of sediment, but I didn't hear they were synthesizing it.
No, in fact, I've got one of my mini oil things. I haven't prepared it, but we can look it up at some point. But yeah, there is a liquefied fuel. Well, I mean, the Germans started this in World War II because they ran out of oil. Especially when the Allies took the Ploiesti fields in Romania. And so what really stopped the Nazi war machine was the fact they just ran out of gas. And that grounded the Luftwaffe, grounded the Panzers, grounded everything. They had just stopped. So that was a major strategic thing. Same thing with Japan, by cutting off the oil lines and supply lines. And so the Germans were big into synthetic fuels because they wanted to have another source of fuel. And so now what they're doing, Gregory was saying, is that millions of years of millions and millions of blooms, of algae blooms, that sank to the bottom of the ocean and were covered with mud. So this mud-algae combination, is what's creating our oil. So it's not fossil fuels. You know, your T-Rex bones are not, you can't drill T-Rex. And we've all seen Jurassic Park. I was joking with him about this yesterday. Amber's on the line too, so I'm going to let her listen for a little bit and then we'll bring her on. But we were sort of joking yesterday that, yeah, those white bones in the rock, no, that's not what your oil comes from. It comes from basically billions upon billions upon billions of tons of algae blooms mixing with mud, forming organic compounds that get compressed with heat and temperature and eventually the cracking process, the same as a refinery with a cracking tower, divides petroleum into natural gas, oil, and coal eventually. And
go on at the mountain of the earth where the temperature is high enough. I've got several petroleum engineers in the family, and that's what they tell me.
Yeah. So it's sort of a combination of the theory. Yes, it's compressed and heated in the mantle of the earth, but the hydrocarbons are not created into oil in the mantle. It does come from organic compounds originally. And, but there's so many of them. Listen to the show yesterday, the first hour. It's unbelievable. Go ahead, Bianchi.
But that whole deal about algae, that's been going on for a while, because I remember a young lady done an experiment of that about 20, 30 years ago in a school. Making the product out of algae.
Well, they're trying
to bypass. There's a lot of things we just don't know about.
Yeah. Well, they're bypassing the time. And I'm going to make Amber's line live so she can join us in, then we'll get into her report.
Can I tell you something else?
Go ahead.
Bitumen was used like we use brick mortar today. Bitumen was used back in ancient times, especially on the pyramids, when they assembled them. They put a layer of it, look like you spreading cake icing on the stone. So, I mean, it's been around.
That's interesting. Yeah. But if they're bypassing the millions of years of compression and temperatures by creating algae blooms now that can then be synthesized into fuel, that's an entirely new market. Maybe, Derek, make a note. Maybe next week we can talk about that. And I also want to get your contact information, introduce you to Amber Kemper, who's our new constitutional reporter. So Derek, meet Amber. Amber, meet Derek.
Good morning.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you. And Derek, of course, you can stick around, but if you're busy, I want to get your contact information before you go. And Amber, I'll make you a theme too. We got to make everybody gets a theme here after you've been reporting for a bit. And so we'll do that as well for you. Derek, let's get your contact one more time.
Cool. Well, thanks, Greg. This is Derek Park of Edward Jones. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
Yeah. And like I say, if you want to hang out for a bit. Amber, did you get a chance to listen to the show before you called in, or are you just joining us now?
I did not. I'm just joining.
Okay. Yeah, it's been a pretty wild discussion all day. We have a lot of crazy things on Fridays. Okay. Well, welcome to the show. Welcome back. Glad to have you. And I'm curious to know where we're going to start our constitutional journey. So you might want to tell a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself again, and then let's see what you came up with.
Awesome. So thank you guys for having me. My name is Amber Kemper, and I am 17 years old. I just graduated high school, and I'm heading to college in Florida for a major in elementary education. I competed in speech and debate almost all 4 years of high school, which I thoroughly enjoyed and loved that. I loved history, everything about it. So
So we're going to be going through.
We'll debate you here, too.
A little bit.
So take it as a personal challenge and feel free to engage. We should give a round of applause. I don't have a theme for you yet, but I can do that. There you go. Glad to have you on board. So, yeah, feel free to debate and engage any of us in conversations. And disagreeing is very cool here. So it's never a problem. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Awesome. Yeah, so each week we'll be going through a little bit of the Constitution, just to kind of gain a deeper understanding of what governs our nation. As many of you know, the Constitution is the longest surviving active piece of legislation, written in 1785 and ratified in 1788. In effect, since 1789, the United States Constitution establishes the foundation of our nation. Each week I'll be, as I stated, gradually going through the Constitution and to gain a deeper understanding of it, of this document.
See, this is going to be good, too, because as I'm finding out as I go through the founding documents, the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, things that my ADHD brain never really read, and now I'm forced to because I have a project that was assigned to me. But I think you're going to find this as good for you as a learning experience as it is, you know, being able to present it to us, because, you know, the biggest reason to become a teacher is so you learn your subject. You know, I learned that as a flight instructor.
Right.
I didn't really start learning about flying until I started teaching it. You know, it was like, oh, that's why that makes sense. So, yeah. So enjoy it. Should be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Where should we start?
Yeah, so this week we're going to start at the beginning, the preamble.
Okay.
You know, when you're in history class, pretty much every history teacher requires you to memorize the preamble. This is the part of the Constitution that everybody thinks of when the word Constitution comes to mind. However, it not only introduces the Constitution, but there's so much more history behind it and how we came to the wording that I really wanted to kind of dig into it.
Do you have earlier versions of it? Do you have like draft versions of the preamble before it was ratified?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Oh,
now I'm really interested. Yeah.
It's really interesting. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But let's start off with like what the wording we have today. So it says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty, to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Hmm.
So as I started researching the preamble, I had the question of how we got to the wording that we have today. And I found a couple websites that specifically government websites that have like the history behind the wording we have today and kind of the drafts that we had. So the first draft was submitted August 6, 1787 from the Committee of Detail. It says, we the people of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Providence Plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, do ordain, declare, and establish the following Constitution for the government of ourselves and our posterity. Now, notice how it doesn't mention the governing power of we the people, the goals of the Constitution, like our final text did. It also lists
what's this for the government?
Of the,
you know, it's interesting that those are the three words that jumped out at me immediately was for the government, the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
and then the final draft is, you know, it starts off we the people, not for the government.
Right.
That's a complete opposite.
Right.
That's a complete flip.
Right, and it's interesting because this draft was unanimously passed by the delegates from the Committee of Detail. And then
what's the Committee of Detail?
From that point,
that's a new term for me. What's the Committee of Detail? And Pianki, feel free to ask questions too. But Committee of Detail, was this part of the original Constitutional Convention or was this earlier a draft committee? Who are these folks?
So there were different committees. The two I'll be talking about today were the Committee of Detail and the Committee of Style. In the Committee of Detail, it was basically like a draft. And then it was sent to the Committee of Style and they kind of made it nicer, made it sound better.
Okay.
It was just, they were the committees that we had for the writing of the Constitution.
Huh.
So it went.
This is new for me, so I'm fascinated. Yeah.
The Committee of Detail is asked them out to the devil is in the details.
Oh. Is that where that comes from?
I don't know where the name came from.
Yeah. But that's a good point she made there. I'm really enjoying this.
Yeah, me too. Okay.
Yeah, so it was unanimously passed by the delegates in the committee of detail. And then it was sent to the committee of style. And this is where it kind of underwent a complete gutting.
Why? Were there objections? And is there a debate that can be read today? Or what was the difference between these two committees? What, different personalities too? Or what are the factors that you discovered?
I was curious on why it was changed as well. And apparently there were no objections to the new change. They just thought it sounded better and it was nicer. But there was a big debate on the wording of "we the people." A couple of the founding fathers were upset by that. They would say, like, "Who are we to say that the people govern the nation?" You know, the Anti-Federalists were one big government, and that's what they wanted. So they were advocating for that, saying we shouldn't give much power to the people, because we don't know what they're going to do with that power.
The Anti-Federalists were saying that? Because this is interesting, because I'm going through the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers. It seems like the Federalists were criticizing the Anti-Federalists were criticizing the Federalists because the Constitution gave the federal government way too much power. You know, the Alexander Hamiltons that talked about, you know, how we need to have a strong federal government so that we can, you know, trade with foreign nations and we can't have insurrections and factions develop and all this other kind of stuff, that it was the federal government that was going to hold the country together. And the Anti-Federalists, oh, wait a minute, you know, we've got the Articles of Confederation.
Yeah.
We're a nation of states that have delegated certain limited powers to the federal government. And the big fear of the Anti-Federalists was that the federal government would become too powerful, which is exactly what happened. So what I'm discovering is that all the fears of the Anti-Federalists came true. The last one I talked about, Anti-Federalist 13, basically predicted our national debt exploding, which is exactly what's happened. So So we the people makes perfect sense. Although it's interesting, I've wondered the same question, and Pianki may want to weigh in on this too. If the states delegated the power to the federal government, why didn't the Constitution start off "we the states" in order to form a more perfect union? Have you asked that? Is there any information on that, or did that come up at all in the debate?
So Patrick Henry said something similar. He said, "Who authorized them to speak the language of 'we the people' instead of 'we the states'? They took characteristics in the soul of a confederation. If the states be not the agents of this compact, it must be one great consolidated national government of the people of all the states."
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And then James Wilson defended the wording, saying all authority is derived from the people, and that the preamble merely announces the principle that people have a right to do what they please with regards to the government.
See, that makes a lot of sense. Pretty interesting. Yeah. Oh, no, it is interesting, but here's another question for you, too. The preamble is not law. The preamble is an introduction, but it is not law. Can you kind of go into that a little bit? Because I think that might be a misunderstanding.
Yeah, so the preamble itself has no legal ground, meaning that you can't go to court for something on the preamble. The preamble kind of sets a foundation for the rest of the document, the rest of the Constitution. It's like the introduction paragraph of an essay. It doesn't, in and of itself, it does nothing, but it kind of introduces and sets up everything that's about to follow and doesn't leave you hanging there.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We had a debate a little earlier in the show, if you want to go back and listen, on the 14th Amendment. We're talking about birthright citizenship. Mm. And I made the point that people, you know, that the 14th Amendment is a citizenship jurisdiction. It's not a geographic one. So just because you're born here on U.S. soil does not make you a U.S. citizen. You have to have citizenship jurisdiction. In other words, your parents, one of which or has to be either an American citizen or a permanent, you know, legal resident, you know, with a green card. because otherwise you're subject to the jurisdiction of other countries. And if you're subject to somebody else's country by virtue of your citizenship, then you can't be subject to the United States, and therefore you can't, you know, have kids that are U.S. citizens simply because they were born in the United States. And the point I made, the reason I mentioned this is because it said, and you look at the preamble, it says very clearly, we the people of the United States, not we the people in the United States. And that is a monumental difference. Even though this is not enforceable in law, it makes very clear that the Constitution, you know, the rights and the restrictions on government and the rights of the people, when we get to the Bill of Rights, it's very clear that it's the people of the United States, citizens of the United States. And so people who are not citizens of the United States are guests and do not have constitutional rights in the same way. They have some, you know, if they commit crime, there's certain criminal rights and things like that. But an illegal alien cannot, you know, have citizenship rights because they're an illegal alien, and you can't have rights in a place you're not allowed to be in.
Right.
And I think people forget that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the rights of the Constitution, this was something we talked about in this last debate year on federal prison policy. You know, the rights of the Constitution are for citizens only. They're not for illegal aliens and not for people who have crossed the border illegally. They're for the people who have earned their right to live here, who have done the work, filed the papers, are citizens, and who live here and understand, like, the full concept of what it means to live here while being a citizen. It's not for those illegals who cross the border illegally.
What are the arguments of the people that were arguing that, you know, just being in the United States, that because they're, and this goes to the Plyler v. Vote, I'll tell you about this one, the Plyler v. Doe decision, which is the one where the court said it wrongly, Brennan and the other leftists said that illegal aliens have to be educated in our school so they can grow up to be productive citizens. And I'm like, well, they're illegal aliens. They can't even be here. So why are you burdening the American taxpayer with people that can't be here? You know, and I give my argument again. You can't have rights in a place you're not allowed to be in. That's irrational.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was the argument they made. And the reason, the logic they said was, well, because these are people. Well, of course they're people. You know, but just because they're people doesn't mean they have rights under the Constitution. You know, that, again, it's a citizenship jurisdiction. But what were the people saying against that said that, well, they're here in the United States, they're people, therefore they have rights? What were they
saying? I don't think I've heard that specific argument.
But
it's interesting because if I'm in your house and I'm uninvited, you have no obligation to feed me, to give me house, to clothe me. You have none of those obligations. You have an obligation to get me out of your house if I'm not wanted, you know, the same goes for our nation and what we're founded on.
Interesting. Piaki?
Well, you know, another thing too, like we call it things space. I think that concept came from Greek, because Greece had what was called city states. And basically it's just like counties are what we call states in the United States, which are really countries. They have their own constitution. They have their own government. They have their own defense. And somewhere along the line, it became states. Actually, it was countries.
Yeah, they could be called nations.
Country
of
Illinois.
We could have been the United
Nations. Country of Michigan.
Yeah. Well, that's how they're supposed to be looked at. But, you know, they were called states. Exactly. I remember writing an article on creating city-states within the United States of independent subdivisions so we don't have to support them. But that's another story. On the actual language itself, do you have comments on a more perfect union or established justice? And, you know, so, yeah, I'm curious how the language – go ahead. This may take a couple of weeks to get through this, I have a feeling, because I have a lot of questions in the preamble. But go ahead.
Yeah, I had a couple of thoughts on each of, like, the general six goals of the Constitution. You know, the first one, to form a more perfect union. President Lincoln actually used this wording to note the importance of the national unity as we faced, you know, the Civil War. But it's unfortunate because we see this wording kind of being abused today. We see a government that is driving us further apart from each other, creating strife and creating victims and oppressors in a society that's not sure we have victims and oppressors, but it's not as, you know, huge as the government is making it out to be. You know,
Well,
they're,
it's almost like
they're not creating.
I see this as an illegal power, that the government is forcibly
right.
separating and segregating us. You know, if segregation is mm-hmm. illegal, then it's illegal. It's illegal. Well, here's a question for you.
Right.
Do you think if we got rid of all racial and gender classifications in government and everybody was treated as an individual without a class or a group, would that go a lot further to equality?
I think that would help, yeah. You know, trying not to, I mean, sure there's racism and sure there's stuff like that, but it's not to the degree that the media and the government is making it up to be. We don't need to make new laws and regulations to kind of combat an issue that's not as prevalent as it's made out to be.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's also personal racism versus legal statutory racism.
Right.
You know, statutory being, you know, black people can't vote in this county without paying $100 poll tax. Okay, blatant discrimination,
right.
horribly illegal. But I think,
right.
you know, everybody, you know, if you know, you want to go to Japan sometime, and I haven't been, but I'd love to. The Japanese really don't think too much of the rest of the world. It's kind of funny. But you want to talk about racism? There's a very racist society. Personally, you know, do they do it by law? I'm not sure. But in this country, you have the freedom to be racist personally. You know, as long as you don't discriminate and, you know, do it in your business and do other things like that. But if people don't like other people for whatever reason, you know, my family's Greek and they don't think much of Turks because of, you know, past wars and confiscations of property and other things, especially going back to World War I. That's a prejudice they have. Is that legal? Sure. You know, does it affect the law? No. You know,
right.
so it's a whole different world of that. Okay. Well, here's a question I have for you, too. On this more perfect union, the previous union seems to me was the Articles of Confederation, where the states had far more power, where the states were much more independent, and when the states really were nations with a very loose, you know, confederation with very few powers delegated to a federal government. Do you believe that when they wrote the Constitution that a more perfect union really meant a better union, better than the Articles of Confederation? What do you think?
I think if I could have, you know, creating unity and bringing these, you know, then countries together to fight a bigger power.
Yeah, that's what the purpose and the underlying reason for using such a word back then was to bring together, like you just said, in order to fight a greater power, because separating like they were be very weak and conquerable.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a good union, but they wanted to make a better one. Well, the idea of more perfect, because perfect is an infinitive. You can't be more perfect. You know, you either are perfect or you're not. There's no degrees of perfection. It either is or it isn't. It is an end unto itself. So to be more perfect is kind of bad English, but it seems to fit really well, though, because I know what they were trying to say. But that's just an interesting twist of language.
Yeah, that was Lincoln's purpose, to save the Union, not to free slaves.
Yeah, but this is written back in the 1700s. This is 100 years before the Civil War. So that's why I think it's interesting. Now, they say establish justice. So was there no justice under the Articles of Confederation, or does that go back to fighting England under the king, under a monarchy? In other words, there's no justice under a monarchy. Therefore, we're going to establish a constitution to establish justice.
Yeah, that very well could have been, you know, what they were going for. What my mind immediately went to is establishing a prison system and establishing kind of law to give us a basis for what's right and what's wrong. You know, saying it's illegal to kill somebody and getting a punishment for that instead of just, oh, it's my right versus it's my wrong. You know, it's not subjective.
But this is written before the Bill of Rights, so they hadn't contemplated those yet. So that's what I'm curious about. So the rights were not set in the law yet. I mean, they were there in the courts and the common law. You know, people had rights, but it wasn't as established as it was with the Bill of Rights. Bianca, did you have a comment?
Well, yeah, it was a concept that people live. Like you said, kill somebody. Well, there's justified and unjustified homicide.
But that's not federal law, though. In fact, we went over this in a show this week when I was talking about, I had a disarmament bill for the government. I'll be sending a press release. You'll get it probably today, tomorrow. one of the big points was that the three crimes in the Constitution that the federal government has jurisdiction over is treason, piracy, and counterfeiting. So if they're establishing justice, my question is, was that the creation of a Supreme Court? Is that what they're talking about? Or was this justice for the nation? Would we be a more just nation under a Constitution than we would be under an Articles of Confederation? That's my question.
Well, you know, you got to look at it, too. A human being, before there was any law, had the right, all the rights of the universe that the universe could bestow upon you. You know, mm-hmm. you had the right to self-defense. You had the right to seek out your means
rights.
Of livelihood.
Yeah, you're talking natural rights.
Natural rights, absolutely.
Okay.
The only way you can lose natural rights is when governments impose laws that restrict those natural rights. Hell, running down the street butt naked. The government says you can't do that. Well, can't do it no more.
Why, did you want to? Don't mind me. Sorry, Amber, we're treating you like an adult on this show, so things happen. But you had a comment, Amber. Where'd you want to go from here?
I don't remember.
That happens to a lot. Don't worry about it. We will get you sidetracked. In between Pianki and me, you're going to get... All right, let's move on from justice. How about ensured domestic tranquility? That's an interesting choice of words because they don't say domestic order. They don't say, domestic law and order. They say domestic tranquility. That implies happiness to me. Amber?
Mm-hmm.
What is domestic tranquility?
So when you put domestic and tranquility together, it kind of means it means peace at home. So my brain went immediately to peace at home. How in the world can the government create peace at home? You know, by keeping out of war, trying to keep us safe, which we'll talk about more in, common defense. But this was like the founding fathers' way of promoting peace between the states. You know, at that time, if they got into a civil war, it would be, the end of the nation. Like, it would not have survived a civil war.
But we did.
Especially with, at the time that this document was being written.
Right. Okay. No, that makes sense. Huh. See, to me, I read it very differently. Which is why I like having you on the show. When I see domestic tranquility, I think of freedom. Because domestic, war was colonial times, colonialism, oppression by a monarchy, the subjugation of people. You know, the war started because we were colonies of England, because they ruled over us and took away freedom. So to me, the greatest producer of domestic tranquility is the greatest freedom for the greatest number, and that would include the state. So the idea is, I guess they were believing that there would be more freedom under a constitution than the Articles of Confederation, because as you get closer to anarchy, you actually get less freedom. As you get closer to tyranny, obviously you get less freedom. So liberty is the point of greatest freedom between anarchy and tyranny, much closer to the anarchy side, because you only want the minimum laws necessary to protect your rights and your property and things like that, and yourself, your safety. Discovered that when I wrote the Australian Bill of Rights. I actually sent that to you. Australian Bill of Rights, we worked on that. And the things we came to is, what is liberty? And that's how we defined it.
I think it had to do a lot with peace, too. Peace, because if you look at Patrick Henry's speech, the gentleman may cry, peace, peace, but there is no peace, for the war has actually begun. So what was going on in the minds of those writers at that time? And I think peace had to be the opposite of peace, of course, in war. I think that had to be a great consideration.
Amber, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think war was definitely on the minds of the founding fathers when they wrote this.
Well, they just lived through one.
Right. It was very, very prevalent, in the society.
Okay. Did you want to go through these word by word, or did you have something else you wanted to do? Because I'm kind of enjoying this, but, I want to give you the option.
No, yeah.
All right.
I definitely had going through it word for word, so.
Well, let's take the next one. Provide for the common defense.
Yeah, I felt like this one was pretty self-explanatory. You know, the founders realized that there was, only an organized and professional military that could respond to both domestic and foreign threats. We can't have a military that's all over the place and under no form of leadership ultimately do nothing. We would be run over and over again. We needed
something
organized and professional.
But you're focusing on the word defense as opposed to the word common.
Common
applies to people. Go ahead, Bianchi. I think you know where I'm with this.
Yeah, common replies to the people. The most common thing that there is you as a person, yourself.
Right. And that's what I was getting to, you know. We have people that fight for our country, fight for our freedom. They, citizens of the United States, you know,
mm-hmm.
they give up their lives for, they've left their families in order to fight for their families. You know, we have that opportunity to fight for our country, and there are people who see a better future in our country and realize that it's worth fighting for.
Hmm. Good point. When I see common defense, I think of the militia. I think of the non-governmental body of the people providing for our common defense against perhaps a tyrannical government in our own country, like we have now. You know, I believe we have I don't know if we've talked about this, but I believe the election was stolen. I believe that Brandon is not a legitimate president. There's no reason for him to be here. We've actually become the victims of a coup, of a traitorous act by both Democrats and Republicans to institute an illegal government in our country. Well, that's certainly not going to ensure domestic tranquility. And as for the common defense, you know, the question is, this is where the Second Amendment comes from, I believe. And that we are a part of the militia. Everybody is. And so to me, when they say the common defense, it's like common law. Common law is not for the government. Common law is for the people. You know, and common law is the experience of using the laws in court. So to me, I think they're really talking about because they were against a standing army. It's one of the things they objected to. Article 1, Section 8 has a provision. The standing army can only be budgeted for 2 years. It can never be permanent. So part of the common defense is the emphasis on the people and the militia and the ability of the people to keep and bear arms, as they define in the Second Amendment. That's what really is the common defense. It's all of us defending our country.
It's like a common court. It's like a common court. You got 10 people. You got 2 people arguing. Well, out of those 10 people, someone has chose to be the judge. They don't have to be a lawyer. It's a common court of the people.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Supreme Court juries at some point. I got a bill on that, but I think absolutely, you know, and it's this hierarchical system is pretty crazy. But Amber, how does that strike you? That the common defense, you know, we've got different ideas on it. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with both of those. You know, it's common defense, you know, is run by the people, you know, with the intention of fighting for the people, you know, and if that means fighting against our own government, go for it. If our government has turned against us as the people, we have the rights to fight against that and to, you know, keep our democracy.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Everything
you said the D word. She said the D word.
Oh.
Well, that does play out at the level. The democracy representation is your congresspeople. But everything goes back to the common people. It's just like in mathematics. It goes back to the common, and the common is the people themselves.
Yeah. Amber, do you have a few more minutes, or do you have to leave at this time? I know you've got a shorter than an hour time with us.
I have about 8 minutes, and then I have to be walking out the door. So,
okay, you can just carry your phone as you go. Well, let's go more then.
Yeah.
this is my favorite. We'll pick this up next week. And first of all, thank you for doing it. I really appreciate having you here. You're a wonderful addition to the show, and definitely a credit to all homeschoolers and young folks of your generation. So you're doing a great job. Promote the general welfare. Oh, please, tell me about that one.
Yeah, this one I found interesting because – you know, it almost seemed like the founding fathers were saying, you know, we need to help combat poverty, help combat, you know, housing shortages or the people that don't have housing, you know, homelessness, you know, food issues, stuff like that. We need to help combat that, which is true, which is why we have nonprofits. But
if the Constitution's a limit on government, why would they give them such an open-ended preamble to basically give out welfare, is what you're describing?
Right. And what I want to emphasis on is the words general welfare.
Ah.
So it's not just for a specific group of people. Yeah. It's for the nation as a whole, for a large group of people. You know, it's not just a couple people here and a couple people there, and certainly not, you know, just for the elite.
But is it the government's job to help people with food and shelter and things like that? I know it gets Bianchi's question.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily their job. It's their job to protect the rights of individuals and to protect us. We, as citizens, have the responsibility to make sure people are taken care of.
Okay.
Yes, that gets into the charitableness of citizens. But just think about this. One of the reasons why the U.S. Navy was formed was in order to protect American goods, the goods of the people, as they traded with foreign people of other lands to protect them as they traveled the seven seas. So that was for the general good of the people. It wasn't for anyone specific, because anyone could take part of it. So that welfare thing is been misconstrued.
That was the point I wanted to make too. Yeah, exactly. That so many people say, "Whoa, general welfare." You know, that means welfare for people. The government has to give out welfare. Nonsense. It's complete. You know, and exactly. But my reading is, but you start off on a different track. That's why I wanted this. I was asking the question. To me, my reading of this is that promoting the general welfare means everything that the government does has to apply equally to everybody. If you're going to promote, and it doesn't say, you know, because it says it differently in Article 1, Section 8. It says provide for the general welfare. So the word promote is really key here, too. There's a difference between providing for the general welfare, which is the way you were describing it at first, and promoting the general welfare. I mean, I think they goof when they say provide for the general welfare, because people say, well, you got to provide for my welfare. No, we don't. That's up to you.
No.
Government's here to protect protect property, protect rights, and protect the nation from invasion and a few other things, you know, but promoting the general welfare, promoting means promoting things that benefit everybody equally. And I think that's what you're starting to say, but I just want to really make that clear. But do you see the difference between promote and provide? Makes sense to you?
Yeah. And, you know, to kind of make an environment to where we can thrive, you know, not make it difficult for any one people group or any of us to get a job, to thrive and make money in our society.
Yeah, Tim, they didn't say promote the general freedom. Yes. Just, you know, I mean, they could have said Bianchi?
That's why they had tariffs. Tariffs is designed to protect domestic manufacturing and production from low cost and whatever from foreign imports. So if you got people here in the United States that's earnestly earning a living, a meager wage and salary, meager profits, well, if you have to protect them from goods coming in that would undercut that, and then all that they have done, the Americans have done, would be for naught. So,
but
yeah,
that does protect their freedom. That protects their freedom because now you're free from unfair foreign competition. That's the level playing field. That's not a bad thing. I don't have a problem with that.
No,
especially protecting Americans
great.
In the world. Yeah. But you can't benefit. See, most of our laws now are special interests. You know, the laws that vaccine manufacturers don't have product liability and Joe's widget company down the street does. That's not promoting the general welfare. That's not the equal protection clause.
But doing away
Amendment.
With pipelines.
Yeah.
Doing away with pipelines.
That's
a
not
special
welfare.
Interest.
Ooh, let's ask Amber that before she goes. What do you think of canceling the Keystone Pipeline as opposed to promoting our general welfare? That's a great point. Amber?
Yeah, that was a little irritating for me, you know. not only are we becoming more dependent on other nations to get our oil and gas, you know, we're creating it harder for Americans to get jobs and to thrive in our nation.
So that's not promoting our general welfare at all. In fact, so
not
one could say that it's the restriction of energy is actually unconstitutional. Huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
It goes against it, and it's an oxymoron. You tell kids to go to school, do hard subjects, and get a good job. But then on the other hand, you do things that eliminate those good jobs.
Now, that's not promoting the general welfare either. This is a really important clause. I'm really glad we're going over this word by word. This is fascinating. I'm sure you have to go, so I don't want to keep you, but you know we would. We could. We keep you for the hour. You're too much fun to talk to. Last comments, and if you have like any website or public information, knowing that you're broadcasting worldwide right now, just curious. You don't have to. You can just you just be Amber, and that's fine too. Concluding comments.
Yeah, I don't have any public website or anything like that.
Okay.
We can continue the preamble next week too, and just continue that discussion, starting with, you know, the blessings of liberty.
And that's a whole comment in itself.
You give us hope, Amber.
Yeah, it's true. Nice report. Let's give her another round of applause here. Don't go away. Wait a minute. There we go. Yeah. And we'll talk to you next week then.
All right. I'll be here.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks.
Now, I have the show here. I have a couple things to play. Because
that's really great, Greg.
She's wonderful. She's amazing. Yeah, I'm really glad to have her on the show.
It's always good to see dividends. That there is human dividends that we have worked so hard for, and hopefully that someone like her springs forth, and that's what she's done. She, like I said, she gives us hope.
Yep. I want to thank her parents, too, for letting her do this. You know, I hope to meet them and talk to them someday because that would be very cool. But they're you know, they're letting her do this, too, so that's really important as well.
Oh, yeah, that's most important.
Yep.
Your children should always be able to start off where you left off, not behind you, but they should build off of what you have created and the cornerstones that you set.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you what. Let me play one of my Federalist Papers. We're going to have about 10 minutes left when we come back to hash out whatever issues you want to hash out. I'll leave that to you, Pianki, to introduce something. I'm going to mute you, and we'll be back in a little bit after our presentations. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Even the title of Federalist Number 12 is bad. The utility of the Union in respect to revenue. First of all, the Union was not created for Alexander Hamilton, who wrote Federalist Number 12, to rule it, nor was the Union created for his utility, nor for the Union to generate revenue. Hamilton says, "The prosperity of commerce is now perceived and acknowledged by all enlightened statesmen to be the most useful as well as the most productive source of national wealth, and has accordingly become a primary object of their political cares." Such grand assumptions. All enlightened statesmen? So those who disagree must be stupid by comparison. Commerce is supposed to bring wealth. That's why we engage in it. But commerce is for private wealth, entrepreneurial wealth, investor wealth, and more. It is not for governed national wealth unless the commerce is nationalized. Maybe that's what Hamilton had in mind when he talked about commerce becoming, quote, a primary object of their political cares. Hamilton and the Federalists appear to believe that not only the Constitution and the federal government should serve elitists like himself, but the commerce of the nation should also. I can see why the anti-federalists were so popular and why people are encouraged by government to study only the Federalist Papers. Consider this paragraph. The ability of a country to pay taxes must always be proportioned in a great degree to the quantity of money in circulation and to the celerity with which it circulates. Commerce, contributing to both these objects, must of necessity render the payment of taxes easier and facilitate the requisite supplies to the treasury. In other words, don't tax more than a certain portion of the money supply so taxes flow in easily. So the goal here is to tax not on the necessary expenditures of government, but on how great a proportion the federal government can tax to facilitate the supplies of money to the treasury most easily. It's also interesting that Hamilton does not trust the states at all regarding commerce or anything else, which is ironic because it's the states that delegate all power to the federal government through the Constitution. But Hamilton is so contemptuous of the states. He thinks their purpose is to conspire to commit commerce in a way the federal government could not tax. Again, according to Hamilton, like people, businesses are to serve the federal government. He says, "The relative situation of these states, the number of rivers with which they are intersected, and of bays that wash their shores, the facility of communication in every direction, the affinity of language and manners, the familiar habits of intercourse, all these are circumstances that would conspire to render an illicit trade between them a matter of little difficulty and would ensure frequent evasions of the commercial regulations of each other." Stating things not at all in evidence that they are in fact evident, Hamilton once again claims that only a national, not federal, national, as in a top-down supremacist government, can be trusted to collect the taxes and keep the treasury full. Whereas the states, which are sovereign entities, will break into confederacies and ruin all Hamilton's plans to run the economy with the national government. He concludes, "It is therefore evident that one national government would be able, at much less expense, to extend the duties on imports beyond comparison further than would be practicable to the states separately or to any partial confederacies." The only thing that is evident to me is that Alexander Hamilton wants a strong national government so his fellow elitists can control the economy and put away money in the treasury based on how much money they can get away with putting in the treasury and use for their own purposes. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. This is Greg Penglis for Strike Force, your source for pure energy. Strike Force is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. It contains caffeine, taurine, B vitamins, and potassium. You make your energy drink yourself. Strike Force energy drinks come in original, grape, lemon, and orange. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strike Force, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code, WYL, to the discount code window at checkout. WYL comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strike Force is at StrikeForceEnergy.com. That's StrikeForceEnergy.com. Start your engines. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Panglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com. You are listening to Action Radio Online with Greg Panglis. The webpage for all Action Radio shows and podcasts is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Please share our show with all your friends and family, both nationally and internationally. The guiding principle of Action Radio is this: we the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed.
Okay, let's bring back Bianchi. We only have a few minutes left, and I am so glad Amber's on the show. We're going to have a lot of fun
and
discover a lot of stuff. Yeah, she's great.
I am too, because she's learning things. See, you know, whether we like it or not, you and I are unusual. And she's hearing things.
Oh, do tell.
If we are unusual, because you keep hearing things that she would not hear from the usual people she come in contact with, especially on particular things like the U.S. Constitution. And you made a point there when you made mention that there's a difference between a national and a federal. Mm-hmm. And what we have is a federal that's completely out of context.
Yeah, people don't understand that. The difference, a national government is top-down. So, and people think we're a national government, even though they say we're federal. A national government, you know, the national government is supreme over the states. The states are supreme over the counties. The counties are supreme over the cities. It's a hierarchical system. That's how most of the world operates. The national government, like a monarchy or a tyrannical government, is a national government. But also a prime minister or president can be a national government if the hierarchy works top to bottom. A federal government, the big difference is that the federal government has certain responsibilities that are completely separate from the states. They have completely separate powers. That's what federalism is. Federalism is a separation of powers, not only within the federal government, but between the federal government and the state governments. And that's the big difference.
Yeah, I would say national is bottom up, from the people to their state legislature on into what we call our state legislature, our state representative, which is democratically elected to represent at that level amongst other representatives of state. Let me give you a good reason why. Sheila Jackson Lee, and I use her, it could be any of them. She wants to pass a bill that governs how you display your guns, your antique guns in your house, if I'm not mistaken.
Well,
why is she wanting to impose that on the whole nation, whereas she's a representative of a portion of Texas? You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
If she's having that problem, if you're having that problem in your elected constituent domain, then address it in your elected constituent domain. Don't try to impose that on me over in Missouri or down in Louisiana or over in Alabama.
Well, she can't impose it on anybody, because the right to keep and bear, to bear arms means to, display them, to either, if you bear them, it means you own them, you have them. You can put them on your wall, you can lock them up in a safe. You know, you can.
That's what she's trying to do with a federal
law,
though,
them.
Greg.
Yeah, but they can't.
That's one of the things with this federal stuff is crazy, too.
Yeah,
that should be state.
But the thing is, it's not keeping. How you keep your arms, you know, is an absolute right, and she can't tell you how to display your firearms.
You got to have you keep a gun in the house. You got to have a trigger lock on it.
That's unconstitutional too, even though it's probably a good idea for a lot of people. You know, and that's the difference between, you know, things that are a good idea and things that are constitutional. Now, you know, is it a good idea to wear a motorcycle helmet? Yeah. Would I make it a law? No. You know, but it's kind of stupid not to. You know, so a lot of these things, you know, is it, if you have kids, is it a good idea to display openly, you know, firearms that are loaded? No, that's a dumb idea. Is it constitutional?
But what I'm saying,
yes,
is that that should only apply to her district. It shouldn't apply to those.
No, it shouldn't apply to
any district.
No, I'm saying it shouldn't apply to any district. Well, she represents a federal office, so when she makes law, when she proposes laws, they have to apply nationally. That's what the Equal Protection Clause is all about. You can't have laws apply selectively.
But if the people in her district want that, see, this is another thing.
But they wouldn't.
See, the rule is
that.
Going the wrong way. The rule should go from the people to the people you elect. The goal to try to get these things into effect. And it's the other way around. You got people that's running, getting elected, and putting things that's their heartfelt conviction into effect, which really, in many cases, don't benefit the people at all.
No, I see what you're saying. But if you, but the problem is that if you want something done, you know, you're going to have to go to the national government if you want it to apply to everybody. You know, and if you go to your state, well, then the national government can overrule your state in a national structure. So it wouldn't matter. And what Sheila Jackson Lee is trying to do is a national. I want this to apply to everybody, even if different states want different things. It doesn't matter in a national system. In a federal system, it does matter. Yeah, this is why federal is so important.
That's where it's wrong. It's wrong.
So people don't understand that states are supreme. Yeah, states are supreme in the areas where they have jurisdiction over the federal government, police powers. You know, all kinds of things. The states are supreme to the federal government. Go ahead.
Brandon's abortion action annexed that he's doing is the Supreme Court has already said that what they did was unconstitutional. So what he's doing is further unconstitutional. The states don't have to comply.
No, but the states didn't have to comply with Roe v. Wade either because the Supreme Court can't make law. Only the legislature, only the Congress can make
law. That's another story, too. That's another
story.
Roe v.
Wade was never constitutional.
What was going on there?
With
what? There was something going on there that needs to be further analyzed with Roe versus Wade.
Was
it a population control?
Well,
was it a population control with a particular people, like Justice Ginsburg made mention in her interview with the New York Times?
Well, in other words, are there reparations to Black Americans for Roe v. Wade? Well, that'd be interesting. Is that where you're going?
Could be.
Okay. No. Well, see, now this is the difference between statutory law, constitutional law, Supreme Court opinions, and, you know, just decent, you know, human decency. So Margaret Sanger was a humanly indecent person. Proposing eugenics to basically exterminate Black Americans through abortions through Planned Parenthood is a crime against humanity. The Supreme Court.
Well, she got the idea from Clarence Gamble of Procter & Gamble.
Oh, that's interesting. Did he have any?
But you know
was
what
he about racist? He must have been avowed racist himself. I don't know anything about Clarence Gamble. Feel free to present him as a profile person. You know, next week that'd be interesting.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
Uh-huh.
If the Democrats have this underlying, I don't even know how you would describe this. They got this very closeness with Black America, but you have their little darling Supreme Court Justice, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, make the statement they didn't want to have too great of, especially in a population we didn't want to have too many of. Now, who was she talking about?
Now, did she say? Was she criticizing
the Democrats? Is real close to Blacks, but on the other hand, they're stabbing them in the back.
Well, I mean, I think that's obvious from the what goes on in Democrat-controlled cities, even by Black, you know, mayors and city councils. You know, I mean, you look at, I mean, there were Jews that cooperated in the concentration camps and the death camps. You know, so you can find people to cooperate against quote, their own people. And I use that term, you know, very reservedly. So it's it's interesting, but you know, when Ruth, I have to take a look at Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Was she, because I don't know if she was entirely for Roe v. Wade because she thought it was a badly done thing. Now, whether she thought the idea of abortion was a bad thing, I don't know. I would hope everybody would, but you know, obviously that's not the case. So
conversation was on the Hyde Amendment as far as using Medicaid for abortion, but
right.
In that loose tongues sink ships, and that's what she had, a very loose tongue. She revealed that. So what she's doing, revealing her innermost feelings. Sometimes people say things that reveal their innermost feelings, mm-hmm. unsuspected by them.
Well, that's why offhand comments are always the most revealing. Do you think that she believed that lessening the black population of this country was a good thing?
I think that Democrats hate black population anyway. I really do. Because look at their action. It's not what you say. It's just look at your action. Then what is derived overall from those actions? And I tell you what, if looking at what has been derived from my standpoint, I wouldn't invest in that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, you look at the history of black Americans and Democrats, and it started, the initial relationship was slave. You know, it was the Democrat Party that started the Confederacy. It was, you know, and then you went to Reconstruction and gun control racism and segregation, and you move up through the Civil Rights Act. It was the Democrats that filibustered the Civil Rights Act. It was the Democrats that divide everybody by race. It's the Democrats that have all these racial classifications for everything. They're dividing the colleges and have separate, you know, graduations. It's always the Democrats that are segregating this country. Republicans don't care.
Black Democrats play it out too. And you know where it's so revealing is mm-hmm. the kids. They don't want they don't want the idea of school choice and being able to pay for that mm-hmm. with what you are being paid now that's not producing anything. They don't want you to leave. It's like mm-hmm. Go down Moses, tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. Mm-hmm. Democrats are the Pharaoh that would not let the people go.
Oh, no. No, I mean, I think the Democrats treat black Americans like farm animals. You know, give black Americans a nice pen, some food, you know, some water, a little shelter, you know, walk around a little bit, you know. That's what they think. You look at and we're talking about, and we got to go because we're a little over time here, but you look at substandard housing.
One more thing real quick.
Yeah.
They treat them like property. Was that mm-hmm. not mentioned when a slave escaped to another state that mm-hmm. they are obligated to return their property where it came from?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'll see you Monday.
Okay, thanks, Bianchi. Yeah, we better end now because we could talk about this stuff forever. But I just want to congratulate Amber once again for giving a great report. And we'll talk to her next week. We'll talk to all our crew, our Friday crew next week. And this is Greg Penglis for Action Radio. This has been a hell of a week. Listen to all the shows. We have our doctor's report yesterday. Gregory Wrightstone, climate geologist, talking about the parallels between CO2 demonization and COVID lies. It's fascinating. We really got into some interesting stuff. Today, our panelists are wonderful. And again, I'm really glad to have Amber on the show. I'll be back Monday morning at 7 o'clock Central Time. And this is Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction, our legislative site for all of the real work that we do here at www.writeyourlaws.com, WriteYourLaws, WriteYourLaws.com. And if you want to contribute to us here, rather than a bunch of Republican geldings, you can go to my paypal.com/paypalme/action radio account. And if you would like to advertise on Action Radio, we are looking for sponsors. And so that is something that you can do to help us out and help our fight for freedom. You know, your investment is going to result in your freedom because that's what we do here. And I'll see you Monday.